Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's stream. Sorry, we're a couple of minutes late. I had a few things to do with the family. Sunday night bedtime's never easy, but here we are. So we might run 5 minutes over to make it up to you. Now, obviously, this is a very important stream, and we're live tonight on Rumble, we're live on Odyssey, we're live on DLive, and we're live on Entropy. And if you want to share this, please do, because this is an important debate, and I'm going to be dealing with this slightly differently tonight to how other people have dealt with this, because I want to ask Joel some really searching questions, and I also want to discuss the wider issues around this debate. So if you can share this, it would be very much appreciated, and I'll be sharing it myself on Telegram in a couple of seconds. Now, I'd like to thank Joel, firstly, for getting up so early in the morning to do this. He's already knocking back the energy drink. And this is an hour later than I usually do stream. So thank you to all the people who have turned up, regardless of the sort of slightly strange scheduling, and to all the Australian guests who have woken up super early. Now, obviously, there's been a lot of people debating this over the last couple of days. There's been a lot of people in my chat debating this today when I announced the stream. So if you want to put a question to Joel, you can through Odyssey or Entropy. If you want to send a super chat, you can. Now, I'm going to ask Joel questions, and depending on the number of super chats, I will ask him questions from the audience in the second half of the show. And we're aiming to go for between about an hour and a half and 2 hours, 2 hours max. And in this time, I want to allow Joel to assert himself, but I also want to ask him questions that are what I think are the most sort of common and overdone critiques of what Joel is saying. And I want to see how he answers those. And I have a few critiques of what he says, and I also have a few questions about certain things that, from my perspective, I find a little bit odd about what's going on at the moment. You might be thinking, what are you talking about? Why is all this odd? Well, I'll explain that in a few minutes. But if you want to put your questions to Joel, you can do. Now, any super chats go to a good cause. So if you do want to make a donation, if you do want to support the stream, please do so. And you can do that via Odyssey or Entropy. As I said earlier, just hit that support button and all funds are gratefully received. Now, let's get into this. I'm going to start listening to the debate because most people have seen the debate. The debate started when Keith Woods wrote an article about this, saying why no one should be invested at all in National Socialism and why it sort of needed to be dumped. And this came on the back of Keith actually doing sort of a debunking of sorts of Europa the Last Battle. Now, I've seen Europa the Last Battle. I think it's excellent. I really enjoyed it. But Keith had a few negative things to say about it. And a few people were like, well, you know, why is Keith doing this? Why is he going down this route, etc.? And look, I really like Keith. I think he's an intelligent guy. I've had him on the show plenty of times. I've not met him in real life, but he seems really nice. He's always very, very affable. But Keith hasn't debated Joel publicly about this. And I think that's a bit of a mistake on Keith's part, because I think if your ideas are going to stand up and they're going to be held to scrutiny, they have to do so, not in the vacuum of your own personal writings on your Substack, but in the open field of debate with your contemporaries. Now, when I was held to account for certain things I said about Vladimir Putin, Russia, Ukraine, etc., well, I went on a debate and I debated Greg Johnson, and around 80% of the people who voted afterwards said they thought I won that debate, which I was happy about. But if I don't feel confident in what I'm saying, maybe I wouldn't have done the debate. But I do feel confident, and I think Keith should debate Joel. I messaged both of them, and I'd have liked them to have done this as an actual debate. But obviously, Joel's come on, and I'm going to sort of play a little bit of devil's advocate here to spice things up a little bit. And I'll also give my personal view nearer the end of this. Now, I'm going to start by saying, look, Joel, I really respect you. I've met you in person. I really like you. And I think you are one of the leading young intellectuals in the worldwide nationalist movement. And you get plenty of praise. You get plenty of fantastic media appearances. And you always do very, very well. You've also been a speaker at one of my events, a Patriotic Alternative event, and you did excellently. Your speeches are always fantastic. And you're somebody who is face out. You're somebody who's put your neck on the line and your name on the line. So if anyone in the chat is going to be sort of besmirching this guy, you know, I've seen some people attacking Joel personally. I think that's very unfair. Joel isn't sort of a faceless, nameless internet pseudonym who comes out and says things. Joel is somebody who is brave enough to say what he thinks and say it under his own name, using his own face. So, you know, I want to sort of keep this clean. And if there are trolls in the chat, I won't have any hesitation but to whack-a-mole them out of existence. So please do be respectful in the chat and, you know, keep it clean. Now, that doesn't mean you have to agree with everything Joel says, but please do sort of keep it clean and no ludicrous accusations being thrown around, etc., etc. Because, as I say, I do value Joel highly. Anyway, let's get into this. I've been speaking for about 5 minutes, and that's 5 minutes too long because everyone wants to hear what Joel's got to say. So, Joel, my friend, I'm going to tap away furiously and send out the notifications to say we're live. But would you like to give us sort of 5 minutes of your position on this? Sort of summarize things in 5 minutes, and then we'll get into this.
Yeah, so obviously I wrote a Substack essay, which was a response to Keith's, because Keith's Substack post was actually a response to me. He referenced a series of Telegram posts that I made, and he literally put like a response to Joel Davis as the subheading of the essay. So I thought I should say something back, and obviously for those that have been around a while would know Keith and I are old associates. I have met Keith in real life multiple times when I've been in Europe. We're old friends. I've known him for like 6 years or something. So, and we've had a lot of discussions about a lot of subjects over the years. So if we disagree on something publicly, it's actually the product of probably a lot of private disagreements over a very long period of time manifesting in some public form. So he decided to make an essay. I thought, this gives me an opportunity to explain my position in a way that's probably engaging for the audience. So then I did an essay myself, but the essay that I did deal with Keith's arguments at the end of the essay, but the bulk of the essay is actually the substance of my position. And this is kind of like two aspects to the debate. One aspect is the question of rehabilitation, and the other aspect is like actually identifying as a National Socialist. In an explicit way. What I was arguing for in a very strong sense was the necessity of rehabilitation, because Keith attacked both notions. I also identify as a National Socialist for various reasons, but the essay that I wrote is primarily a defense of the rehabilitation of National Socialism, why even if you want to call your nationalism by a different term, or you want to embrace nationalism in a slightly modified way or whatever, that there needs to be a project of rehabilitation of many of the elements of National Socialism so that you're free to use them, essentially, so that you don't have to do nationalism with the training wheels on, so to speak. So you don't have to do nationalism under the limitations of distinguishing yourself from the National Socialists, which I think is undoubtedly a reality that we face in the contemporary situation. There was like one part of Keith's original article where he basically almost said, oh, well, you know, it's becoming irrelevant these days, World War II and the Nazis, and it's fading away, so we should just let it fade away. But the whole premise of the article itself was that it's actually, you know, nuclear, you know, there's all this stigma around National Socialism, and so attaching ourselves to it in any way, in any kind of positive way, is actually really negative. So it doesn't make any sense. You can't have it both ways. Like, either the stigma exists or it doesn't. And I think it obviously exists. Like, I don't know how you can say that it isn't still probably the most controversial subject in all of politics. So clearly that's there, right? Also, there's the reality that the entire post-World War II international order has really been built around a response to the Second World War and the ideological dispute that, you know, retroactively became the meaning of the Second World War. Now, it's all of these like more geopolitical or economic or like, you know, practical reasons why World War II came into existence. But ultimately, the meaning of World War II, according to its victorious allies, was the destruction of the ideology of National Socialism. So, you know, like apparently the reason why we had to declare war on Germany at the beginning was because they invaded Poland and we gave Poland a security guarantee, but the war ends with Poland under Soviet control anyway. And the Soviets also invaded Poland and we didn't declare war on them. In fact, we allied with them against National Socialism. So,
well, look, you know, this is getting into the weeds already. I mean, let me start this again in a way that I think is a better way to start this. So I've been involved in this cause for 2.5 decades. And when I first got involved, most people that I met in the cause were in some way either openly sort of National Socialists, covertly National Socialists, or they'd been influenced in some way by National Socialism. Mm. Now, the first thing I find very difficult to sort of comprehend about Keith's position is the complete disavowal of National Socialism is odd, because whether you're a National Socialist or not, and whether you identify as a National Socialist or not, I've got to say that pretty much any genuine nationalist movement in the world today shares the two central tenets of National Socialism, which are the nationalism and the socialism. You do this for your people, which is the nationalism. You do this for your country. You do this because you want a homogenous, closed-bordered nation. That's the national. But you do this because you want your people to treat each other like a family. You don't want your people to be preying on each other. You don't want the rich preying on the poor. You don't want the owners of capital preying on the worker. You want the workers and the owners of capital to work hand in hand. You want the rich to give the poor a leg up, and you want the poor then to, you know, work hard so the rich have the capital to help the poor up further. There is a social aspect to nationalism. So National Socialism, whatever you say about it, those two central strands run through every nationalist organization that is alive today, that is up and going. So I looked at when I was involved in the BNP, you know, we went out into working class communities and we told those people that we wanted British jobs for British workers. We wanted a homogenous society. We wanted to end immigration. We wanted a fair wage for the working man. We wanted to make sure the NHS worked for normal people. Now, the BNP was not a National Socialist Party by any means, but to deny that there wasn't the national and the social in the BNP would be to deny reality. And really, I see where you're going with this, but, you know, I felt that everyone that's spoken to you about this, without being disrespectful to the people who have spoken to you or talking over you, have failed to grasp the fundamentals of this debate. And where I'm coming from is to say that National Socialism has no relevance would be to say that every nationalist movement today that incorporates the national and the social also has no relevance. And whilst these movements may not be National Socialist, you can see where they've come from and you can see a synergy. And this is where I didn't really understand Greg Johnson or Keith Woods's position, because you can't. I don't see how you can deny what I've just said, but please give your perspective.
Well, yeah, well, like in my essay, because as I said, the essay fundamentally was a defense of my position on the basis of itself, and then I dealt with some of Keith's criticisms, what I thought his main criticisms were at the end, in light of that. And I basically broke down my position into three main subjects. The first is that nationalism isn't an ideology in my view. Nationalism is an idea, but it's an idea that has historically been mixed with other ideologies, in particular liberalism. So from the late 18th century up until the early 20th century, there was a lot of like nationalist liberal movements, but there's been plenty of other kinds of nationalist movements as well throughout history. Nationalism is itself can just be seen as an idea, not necessarily the only idea which is of concern, or even the most fundamental idea. It can just be one of many ideas that are considered valuable by a particular political party or movement or what have you. So my point was that nationalism needs an ideology to serve it. And if you value the nationalist idea to its most fundamental, I believe National Socialism is a political ideology that is basically built entirely out of the nationalist idea without basically taking in any other elements. It's basically starting at the idea of nationalism and then working it out to its absolute logical conclusion. And that's what differentiated it from many of the liberal nationalist movements of its time and prior to its time, because National Socialism purged all the liberal qualities from nationalism. This is significant because of the second part of my argument, which was a dialectical argument, which is that basically nationalism and liberalism have become incompatible, not just because of the decision, like some kind of like specific concrete decision to turn nationalism against liberalism because there was a bunch of nationalists who didn't like liberalism, but because actually nationalism as an idea and liberalism as an idea are actually contradictory. And I appealed to the work of Carl Schmitt, particularly his Crisis of Parliamentary Democracy, to make that point, because he basically said this in the early 1920s. He was probably the greatest German political theorist of his time. He obviously ended up joining the party. Carl Schmitt is still studied today as one of the great political thinkers of all time, despite that association. You know, someone's a really excellent intellectual when they could have been a Nazi and they still get taught in the universities in the contemporary era, like, you know, Martin Heidegger, Carl Schmitt. It's a very like rare Nazi intellectual that's just too good to cancel, right? But Carl Schmitt basically predicted and articulated what was happening and predicted the 20th century, the trajectory of politics, where liberalism and nationalism would turn against one another and become enemies where previously they had been allies. And that was mostly galvanized by, particularly from the late 18th, early 19th century, their mutual opposition to monarchy in various respects. So you can think of a few examples of this, like say, you know, you're in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, right? You're in this multi-ethnic empire and you are a nationalist and you want to liberate your particular ethnic group from some multi-ethnic empire. Well, obviously you're going to kind of find common cause with a liberal notion of popular sovereignty, we can liberate ourselves and create a parliamentary system that represents our people directly. Or, you know, look at like the French Revolution and its consequences. You know, if you're going to come along and say, well, we speak on behalf of the French people by virtue of the fact of our parliamentary system, and the king doesn't, the king is the enemy of the people or whatever, you can appeal to nationalism and legitimate a liberal revolution like that. Or in America, there are appeals to nationalism to differentiate the American interest from, you know, the British Empire, and the list goes on. So there was a tension between nationalist interests and monarchical interests, and therefore common cause was found historically for various reasons. But then basically the old monarchies of Europe were largely, by the end of World War I, they'd been largely defeated. Now liberalism had a pretty totalizing victory over Western European politics. But liberalism for Schmitt is built around this idea, because liberalism is built on the notion of the social contract and the constitution. Liberalism is built around this idea of basically protecting the rights of individuals and the rights of minority groups against the majority will. It's not, Americans will often say we're a republic, not a democracy or something. Like, you'll hear conservatives say that. Well, that's what that idea is, which is that, well, you have certain rights and liberties as an individual or as a minority group, which the state can't violate even if the will of the majority is against you. Well, this is actually in direct opposition to the pure notion of popular sovereignty, the pure notion of democracy, which is that the will of the people should triumph. And the will of the people isn't just, okay, if we've got like, you know, a set of voters and 50% plus one of our citizens vote for something, that means it's the will of the people. No, that's not what Rousseau meant by the notion of popular sovereignty or the general will. And that's not what Schmitt is talking about. The popular sovereignty or the general will, to use the Rousseau's term, as understood by Schmitt, is people who think in terms of the common interest, in terms of the national interest, right? So what National Socialism means is putting like the social, in the sense the interests of society at large, first. But obviously, that is understood in national terms. The national community's interests come first before any individual or minority group interest, class interest, whatever other type of interest. So, therefore, the idea of democracy can only really be realized in the idea of nationalism, in the idea of putting the national interest before any of these other minority groups, or including the individual themselves. And so, therefore, there's this collision course between the idea of liberalism and the idea of nationalism, where, and that's built into the notion of liberal democracy, that actually you can't have democracy without nationalism. Actually, democracy is illiberal when taken to its final conclusion as a notion. And so that mutual collision course that was built into the ideas ends up realizing itself in a very concrete way in the 20th century. And that's what I posit National Socialism was the ultimate historical materialization of, and the making concrete of, was this phenomenon. Because the National Socialists recognized that, you know, a liberal order, which was imposed upon Germany by their defeat in World War One. Obviously, there was liberal elements in the German state prior to World War One, but the Germans were obviously unique in Europe in how much they resisted liberalism. And you can see this in, and this is the third part of my argument, which is Germany's unique historical role, which is that obviously in Western Europe, particularly at that time, you have like some major powers, you know. Germany is a major power, France is a major power, Britain's a major power, and I guess you could say like the Russians / Soviet Union. And the Russians / Soviet Union are kind of like the odd man out in Europe. They kind of got one foot in the door, one foot outside the door, and that's a complex thing. But in Western Europe, it's a very kind of cohesive culture in the modern world, where the development of German culture, French culture, British culture, and all the other smaller nations surrounding them, it's kind of all happening in a kind of collective dance called modernity. You know, everyone is, you know, listening to each other's music, reading each other's philosophers, and Western Europe develops kind of together. Obviously, there's national differences, but it develops together. And where the British and the French really anchored their political traditions in the Enlightenment and in liberalism, the Germans were far more resistant to it. The Romanticist movement in reaction to the Enlightenment in the late 18th, early 19th century, it was all over Europe, but it was really dominant in Germany.
But Joel, you're giving a great sort of history lesson and sort of justification of National Socialism in sort of the 1920s and 30s. But really, what I was asking you is, the debate is whether it's sort of relevant today.
Well, but it is relevant because we live in history.
No, but so I sort of couch this as sort of like every popular nationalist party today takes the two central strands from the National Socialists and weaves it into what they do, the national and the social. And I just sort of wanted your take on that, to whether you think that's actually what is happening. Because if that is happening, then it is undeniably relevant.
Yeah, I think that's true, but it's important to understand things dialectically. In other words, that ideas have a history, and that ideas work themselves out through trying to actually manifest themselves, particularly when we're talking about politics, in a concrete form, where they start realizing who their friends and enemies are through the process. So, obviously, the liberalism of the 18th century is not the same as the liberalism of today. The socialism of the 19th century is not the same as the socialism of today, because these movements, as they started trying to concretely realize themselves, had shifting alliances. So liberalism once was allied with nationalism, now it's against it. Socialism once anchored itself in the white working class of Europe, now it anchors itself in, you know, basically third world immigrants and homosexuals and feminism and so on, and it's changed a lot of its core commitments. Well, to understand why that is, you have to understand the actual process of history. And so, because the appeal,
I think that's the argument against what you're saying, Joel, is that so there's several arguments that I didn't really want to get into this straight away, but I was more sort of hoping you'd sort of discuss how and why it is relevant today. Because, I mean, Keith's major argument, or one of Keith's major arguments, or one of your major detractors' arguments, is that, you know, a history lesson's a great thing, and sort of discussing, you know, why things were relevant, how they came about, how they grew in that era is fascinating. But we're in 2025 now. You know, National Socialism sort of burnt in the fires of Germany in 1945. And, you know, we're 80 years on from that now. I was more sort of looking for your perspective on why it is, or why you believe
here's why it is. Mark, because I'm an, for example, as an Australian, to make it more concrete, as an Australian, we have obviously a white nationalist tradition. Australia was federated in 1901 under the leadership of a white nationalist movement. Obviously, we didn't rebel against the crown. In retrospect, we probably should have, but we didn't. I don't say that because of any kind of anti-Anglo sentiment. Obviously, I am an Anglo-Saxon, but the reason why I say that is because there were some radical elements in our nationalist movement that wanted to rebel against the crown and put the White Australia policy in our constitution. And basically, we were watered down quite significantly by the British Parliament in some of the more radical aspects of what wanted was aimed for by the nationalist movement. But nevertheless, we established the White Australia policy through legislation, and we built a white nationalist country. We had a nationalized banking system. We had a very good government, comparatively speaking, prior to the Second World War in Australia. Noble, good nationalist men. And so people say, Joel, why are you worried about this Hitler stuff? You know, Australia had these great nationalist leaders to begin with. They had a strong, robust white nationalist tradition. Why not just focus on the Australian nationalist tradition? Why even bring in this foreign German stuff? And the response to that is very simple. The Australian white nationalist tradition, which I do look to and I do admire and I talk about frequently, and obviously is part of our history, so it would be silly not to, it was fundamentally a liberal tradition. So I don't believe that we can have a solution to what is the world that we now exist in, which is a world in which liberalism and nationalism have turned against each other and are now enemies, where the project of global liberalism is fundamentally anchored in destroying nationalism and preventing any real nationalism from existing. I don't believe it's possible to create a liberal version of nationalism that's viable. I think we have to accept the reality of where we are in history, that nationalism has to oppose itself to liberalism. And so therefore, I have to go and look to historical situations where that happened, where nationalist movements of our counterparts in Europe turned on liberalism, and why, and what methods they used to then draw inspiration to create a liberal nationalist movement in Australia, because there wasn't one in any kind of serious way in our history. We didn't need one necessarily, because liberalism hadn't fallen into this crisis of contradiction until the post-World War II international order came about through the defeat of National Socialism, and liberalism became, you know, more self-consciously an anti-nationalist project, where liberalism's core commitment now is defending basically minority rights and interests against the assertion of the majority will. That is very explicitly the project now, and that's it's basically the official state policy of my country now. How did that come into being, and why, and what do you do about that? Well, what you do about that is you assert the majority will in a direct political form. And there is no form more pure that I can see in history of doing that than the National Socialists of Germany, where it was a completely totalizing and comprehensive political project anchored in that fundamental principle. And so that's why I derive not only inspiration from that project, but also why that project needs to be rehabilitated. Because if that project is demonized and is considered this great historical evil, and there isn't some kind of revisionist process where we can bring those ideas back into the discussion, where we can consider them again in an open way and consider their strengths and weaknesses or whatever, we can't have that kind of mature discussion about them. We then basically have completely cut ourselves off from being able to form a robust and militant illiberal nationalism that is capable of doing what is necessary, in my view, to save our people. Because I think only a radical political project is ultimately going to be capable of addressing the great crisis of demographics, the way in which, for example, my country, but this is true for pretty much every country, the way in which we've been integrated into this global marketplace and we've lost so much of our economic sovereignty, in addition to having all these foreigners brought in, and our elites are all traders that are part of an international clique. And obviously the role of Jewish subversion, but not just that, communist subversion, and so on. When the National Socialists came to power, they eradicated Marxism. They removed Jews from all positions of power. They completely crushed Freemasonry. They wiped out all the enemies of the German people from political life and from public life. They banned foreign-owned media. They banned Jewish-owned media. Only media that was by the German people, for the German people, in the interest of the German people, was able to exist. And so they protected the collective psyche of their people from subversion by alien and hostile foreign elements. That isn't a liberal idea. That's an idea, nevertheless, that I support and is necessary. And, you know, a liberal nationalist movement isn't able to be as totalizing, where you could seize state power, where you could use state power to totally crush the enemies of your people and instantiate a positive project of basically developing the blood and quality of the race of your nation in very explicit terms. National socialism does this. National socialism also has a intense realism about human nature and the human condition, the reality of struggle, the reality that ultimately to, you know, because nationalism is built on this idea of self-determination, right? And you hear a lot of, you know, the concept of the so-called right to self-determination. Apparently, liberal world order gives all the nations that make it up, it recognizes that they have a right to self-determination, apparently. But it's an ideological phantasm. You don't actually have self-determination unless you are powerful enough to assert it. If your right to self-determination is guaranteed by another country or a set of international alliances that you're subject to, you're not actually determining your own destiny. You're subject to their whims. So you can see the so-called American guarantee of self-determination. It doesn't really feel very much like self-determination. It gives you the right to essentially have the ideology that the U.S. State Department wants you to have, which just so happens to correspond with you being softcore genocided in your own country, nationalist movements being suppressed so that they can't assert them any kind of like independent will from this process, and your entire economic and financial system being integrated into an international system that you don't control, run by foreigners who don't give a shit about you and exploit you essentially for their own benefit. So that's why national socialism needs to be rehabilitated, because the demonization of the set of ideas that are bundled underneath national socialism is the demonization of a bundle of ideas that need to be applied to create a comprehensive political solution to the problems that are facing us as nationalists today. If we have to cuck ourselves and limit ourselves to only doing nationalism within a liberal framework, we will not create a political movement that is radical or revolutionary enough to achieve the victory that is necessary.
So basically what you're saying is that the fundamental strands of National Socialism are still relevant today and more than ever necessary. And by basically disavowing and pretending that's not the case, we limit ourselves and we actually put a barrier between ourselves and creating the movement you believe we need to win back our freedom. Is that pretty much your point?
Yes, because if you start doing anything that is or advocating for anything...
Can I ask a follow-up then? Because, you see, the biggest argument against what you're saying, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier, I said the BNP was not a National Socialist Party, but at its core were what you could have said were the national and the social. There was the nationalism and the socialism. There was the desire for a homogenous nation, but there was also a desire to ensure that people work together for the greater good of the community and to treat each other as part of an extended family. So you could say at the core of the BNP's principles, as you could argue at the core of, say, any nationalist organization's principles, are the national and the social. But the BNP believed that by wrapping up those principles in something that was more British, in something that was more relevant, and in something that didn't come packaged with the baggage of the Second World War, with the baggage of Hitler, with the baggage of decades of brainwashing, it would be easier to sell. So it wasn't that the BNP had given up on the ideas, but the BNP believed that by, and I keep going back to the BNP because I was involved in the BNP, and the BNP were electorally the most successful openly sort of ethno, not the most successful right of the Conservative Party movement by a long way, but the most successful ethno-nationalist organisation in British history. And the people running it believed that that was the best thing to do, to hold on to those central strands, but to repackage them in a way which wasn't so off-putting to normal people. Because, you know, we're, as I said, we're in 2025. There's been 80 years of intense brainwashing, intense social conditioning. And do you think there's any mileage to taking those central strands, stripping away certain sort of associations, and selling sort of nationalism and community in a way that would be less easy to demonize? So say, rather than using a swastika, you use the Australian flag, or rather than, you know, putting a picture of, you know, Hitler front and center, you would, if you're in Britain, you would take British heroes. And another thing about this, and this is something which nationalists have always found it very difficult to, a barrier nationalists have always found it very difficult to get past, and I've spoken about this very many times, here in the Anglosphere and in Britain, Britain especially, there is this sort of foundational myth that came about at the second, after the Second World War, that Britain was founded on the idea of opposition to foreign dictators, and the idea that the sort of Britain was this plucky little upstart nation that went around defeating people like Hitler. And that's when Britain was born. Britain was born out of sort of two world wars and one World Cup, as ridiculous as it sounds. How do you respond to that allegation, that selling what, that we don't have much time left? I mean, here in Britain, they're saying 2066, where white Brits are a minority. White British children could be a minority in schools by 2035 easily, by just past 2030, if current trends continue as they are today. And people will say, well, look, we don't have much time left. We don't have time to sort of educate the masses. We don't have time to break down 80 years of brainwashing and conditioning. We need to take these core fundamentals and repackage them in a way that is more saleable to the man on the street and less likely to scare people away. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say that that's a distinct issue. Like, my argument is not that everyone needs to package themselves as National Socialists. That was not my argument. My argument was that a project of rehabilitation is necessary so that any illiberal nationalist package that you try to create can have legitimacy. My argument is from the standpoint of ideological purity, which people often use this word purity, or particularly ideological purity, as if it is like a negative thing. They use the phrase like purity spiraling. They say this is a negative thing. Taking your own ideas seriously, it's not a negative thing. That's actually an insane position to uphold, because basically you're showing a lack of confidence in your own ideas. We are not going to convert the masses to any ideology, because the masses are not ideological. What we can do, however, is convert the radical portion of society, or a very substantial portion of them, people who do want to develop an actual worldview, people who are interested in actually participating concretely in politics, making individual sacrifices towards a political movement, giving their time, their resources, taking risks with, you know, obviously in our line of work, with potentially running afoul of law enforcement and so on. There's only a certain subset of the population that is willing to do that kind of thing. But that subset of the population are also the subset of the population that have way more political agency than voters, right? I don't build my political strategy around just simply how to appeal to voters. I want to build a political strategy around how do I get that 1% of radical nationalists into a room fired up and inspired, where they're willing to run through brick walls for the white race. Because if you have that 1% of the population ready to do that, organized into a serious political movement, then you can show strength to the people. Then you can show something quite impressive to the people and win them over on the basis of, look at my 100,000 strong nationalist movement. Look at how cool they look in their uniforms. Or in Britain, you can't wear uniforms, but you know, look at the excellence that we have on display. Look at the fact that we can show the people that we've got a real force that can fight for you, that we don't just have an idea. We've got people that are organized around an idea that are willing to fight for that idea and challenge an elite that you hate. So it becomes a dance. It becomes a story. Rather than it being just about the ideas in the abstract, it becomes this concrete group versus that concrete group. And under those conditions, I think it's a lot easier to win people over to supporting a radical political movement as voters or whatever when it's actually material. When they can actually see the leaders, when that movement can actually do concrete things in their community for them, where they can meet individuals from that movement, they can see that they have sincerity, they can see that they have a plan for taking down a corrupt government that everyone hates. Like the legitimacy of the British government or the Australian government is at an all-time low. I've never experienced this in my lifetime, and it's only getting worse and worse each year. But the thing is that even though pretty much everyone agrees that the establishment is corrupt, that the system is failing, that basically by every metric society is getting worse, they don't really see an alternative. You need to build an actual horse for them to back. That horse is not going to be built on the basis of the opinions of the masses. The opinions of the masses move last. It needs to be built upon the willpower of a committed radical minority that are happy to be unpopular because they believe in an idea on the basis of principle. And so in order to win those people over, you actually need to have pure principles. You actually need to have a romantic vision that is built in the essence of what the idea is that they're going to struggle for. People are not going to go to jail for an optical marketing strategy. People will go to jail, however, for an idea that they truly believe in with their whole heart. So that's what I'm kind of focused on. When that exists, and that can basically...
I'll give you an example of that that supports your point, because I've brought up some stuff that's critical of the things you've said, but I'll give you an example of some things that are actually supportive of what you've just said. Now, when the BNP, when I joined the BNP, as I said, most people in it most activists and leading members would have described themselves as national socialists. And there was an undercurrent of it in the party. Now, those people would have all gone to the wall for the organization. They would have all happily gone to jail if they'd have had to. Now, interestingly, as the party became less and less like that, and people like that were increasingly forced out of the organization, the party did gain more electoral traction, and it did become electorally successful. But the interesting thing was, the people who were attracted to the party, the sort of soft, fluffy, squishy newbies who didn't have any affinity to the sort of ideas you're talking about and were not ideological in any way, well, the first bump in the road that the party hit, the first bad election, and all those people left and bailed. And because there was no hardcore people left in the organization, there was nobody left in the organization. You see, throughout all the lean years, throughout all the bad years in the BNP where nothing was happening, there were still a few thousand members. It wasn't a relevant organization because you need a lot more than a few thousand members to be relevant. But those few thousand members kept it ticking over, and they never left because they had something that kept them wedded to the movement, this belief in something greater and an ideology. But once you got rid of that hardcore and attracted a bigger, you know, electorally stronger base of less ideological people, the first bump in the road and all of those were gone. And I do think there is a weight to your argument that an ideological core of people are less likely to be broken and more likely to stick at bringing about what they desire than sort of, you know, your soft Johnny come lately, Brexit party, you know, Australia First voters who, you know, will go back to the mainstream at the drop of a hat at the first, as I say, electoral bump in the road. So I think that's an important point you just made there. you know, there is something to be said about, you know, sticking to something you believe in. But there's also something about this which we have to sort of bring up. When you look at what National Socialism was, National Socialism was a very, very ordered, structured, clean movement based around excellence. I think one thing that does put people off National Socialism today is that National Socialism does attract a lot of cranky people. It attracts a lot of weirdos. It attracts, you know, there are groups in America where, you know, you see people walking down the street with swastika flags and they've got tattoos all over their face and piercings and gold teeth and stuff like that. I look at that and I see that as a parody of National Socialism. What would you say about some of the weird recreations of National Socialism today? Do you see those as genuine people, or do you see them almost as sort of like Hollywood Nazis attracted to the movement because of a negative stereotype? So they think that if they're involved with that negative stereotype, they're the big bad guy and that makes them feel special. Do you think that's a problem for this as well?
I think maybe historically that has been a problem in various instances where, but I would say a few things. Number one, someone doing a bad job isn't a repudiation of that idea. It's just them doing a bad job. The question is, well, what if you did a good job? So yeah, like for example, our organization, we're always trying to like raise the standards. You have to start somewhere. And that same was true for the NSDAP. They didn't start where they finished in terms of their aesthetics and their propriety and so on. There was a lot of street thugs in the Hitler was in the streets punching with them, punching on with communists and so on. It did have a pretty rough beginning in many respects. It was a bunch of street thugs that kind of got together that spurged out over, you know, German nationalist theory at the pub, and then went out and started bashing communists in the street. Like, that's one way of describing its origins. You know, there's more to it than that, obviously. But so there is that element. Over time, they refined and they became more sophisticated, and they grew and so on. And the uniforms got better, and obviously very keen interest was paid to the aesthetics of the presentation of the party, and it's the most distinctive aesthetic style we've ever seen in political history before or after that still completely captures the imagination of people to this day. So obviously that's a lot to aspire towards. Hitler himself was literally an artist, and so in order to be able to replicate anything of that quality is going to require a lot of work. You can't just like get a bunch of your mates together and pull off NSDAP 2 and think that it's going to be as good, right? So it's a difficult thing to accomplish, and also we're not necessarily doing the exact same thing they were doing either, because it's different conditions and so on. In Australia, for example, Australia has certain energies in the national psyche which we're trying to tap into, which is specific to Australia, that maybe don't resonate with foreigners. And part of that is because we've got this kind of convict outlaw mystique in our national identity that subsists, right? Where there's this kind of like romantic love of the, you know, the Kelly gang and the, you know, the Irish kind of convict energy and so on, that kind of rebellion against authority. That's why Australians are very, we have what they call tall poppy syndrome. We like people who are high status to humble themselves and show that they're one of the people. We're not like Americans where we celebrate like celebrities and like, oh, this guy's got so much money and status, like let's hero worship him. Australians are the complete opposite of that. Australians like the underdog. Australian nationalism was very much built around the worker and the dignity of the Aussie battler and all of these motifs. And even our kind of like wartime mythology is built around these guys just being farmer boys or workers who, you know, hand him a rifle and send him against the Japanese, and he's he's like an elite athlete though. Like, and it's like that idea that the average Aussie has actually got incredible or extraordinary qualities despite having a rough and maybe unsophisticated exterior. That's kind of part of our like national identity. And so like we are going to have to tap into that if we're going to start accessing that. So a little bit of that outlaw aesthetic is good for us in our opinion, where foreigners might look at that and go, oh, they're playing into stereotypes. I don't think that would work as well somewhere like America, where they have a completely different culture. For example, in America, you know, they admire status, they admire the kind of this kind of refined, sophisticated individual who's, you know, the excellent businessman or the Hollywood, you know, movie star or whatever. They've got a whole different national mythology, and there's reasons for that I don't want to go into. But so you've got to adapt to your local culture. Obviously, you've got to tap into, you know, the so-called folkish spirit, right, of your own people, and that to do it authentically. And it would be different for Britain. It'd be different for, obviously, in Germany. It's different in Australia. It's different in different countries. But at its core, the question is, are you a group that really takes yourself seriously? Because if you don't take yourself seriously, then society isn't going to take you seriously. And I think the issue that a lot of people have had with National Socialists in various instantiations, I'm not going to name any names, is that they don't come across in a way where it seems like they're even taking themselves seriously. They're not presenting themselves like, could these guys really be an alternative to the current political establishment? Are these guys really capable of governing in any kind of way? So you have to be able to develop, even if you're going to have characteristics that differentiate yourselves from the establishment, you have to convey a sense of authority and a sense of seriousness, moral seriousness, political seriousness, and so on. That has to come through in how you behave. But again, these are all practical questions. The question is, are the ideas in National Socialism good or not? Like, is it a good idea to remove all Jews from positions of power? Is it a good idea to go and, like, destroy Freemasonry? Is it a good idea to ban Marxism from publicly organizing in your country? Is it a good idea to have a racially homogenous nation? Is it a good idea to try and develop sovereignty, not just in by the word sovereignty, but actually have gear the energies of your people towards developing the economic and military means of kind of choosing their own destiny in this world? These are fundamental principles that are in National Socialism, which I think are good, and I think Australia needs if Australia is going to survive. Like, the white Australian people are going to survive. We're going to take this continent back and achieve its full potential. That's why I'm a National Socialist. I believe in those principles. So I think those are good principles. If you come along and said, oh, well, why don't you just have all those principles but call it some other name, I'm fine with someone saying that. I'm not going to call it another name. But when you do that, you bundle it together and you assign a different name to it. At the end of the day, there's still going to be a discourse that's relevant to the Nazis, because they're going to call you a Nazi for doing a bunch of stuff and believing a bunch of stuff that the Nazis believed and did. And so you can spend all of your time saying we're not like the Nazis because, well, actually, and write like long TLDR multi-paragraph explanations on how you're not like the Nazis because of this or that reason. And that's fine. But at the end of the day, there's going to need to be some kind of reckoning with the idea, well, what's so bad if we have similarities with the Nazis? Why would we not admire a movement like that as opposed to denigrate it? Why are we operating under like the morality of the enemy, where we're kind of implicitly agreeing to this idea that National Socialism is this historical evil that we need to prove that we've differentiated ourselves from? That's not showing strength of character and willpower, I don't think, at all. If we truly believe in our ideas and take them seriously, and we get compared to the Nazis, we should see that as a compliment. Because that was an incredibly successful movement that, you know, basically the entire world had to unite together to defeat in the greatest war of all time. Like, that was an incredible expression of political willpower and of taking what was initially a grassroots movement of like 80 guys in a pub spurking out about political theory. They went from that to that. Like, that's an incredible story. So we should look to it as a form of inspiration. And if you don't look to it as a form of inspiration, you're either lying, or I think there's something spiritually defective about your nationalism, because in every sense in which the Nazis were extreme or you know, to use that label, or were kind of brutal or militaristic, is a respect in which they were simply willing to do more to achieve what was necessary in a certain, they took the idea of securing a future for their people, and not just a future, but a powerful and dominant future. And there's also like the secondary aspect of this, which is that what the Germans were fighting for, they were fighting for themselves in the sense that they were German nationalists. But what they were fighting for in a historical sense was a different form of Western civilization, was for a Europe organized around their set of ideas and principles, as opposed to the ideas and principles of the communists or the liberals. And that is this kind of like great kind of historical specter which we now live in. Is Western civilization going to represent these kind of romantic nationalist ideals? Is it going to represent this kind of, you know, in my view, World War II was a metaphysical war between the particular and the universal. Where do you side on that debate? Are you on the side of the particular or on the side of the universal? And to me, I'm on the side of the particular. And I think if the white race doesn't side with the particular, it will no longer exist. That the collective political, cultural, philosophical, and spiritual domination of the white race and our collective culture and civilization by the universal is fundamentally what is bringing us into this existential confrontation with our own demise. This is even more fundamental to me than the role of Jews or anything like that. All of that is a symptom of this more fundamental disease, I believe, of universalism, this metaphysical disease, if you will, where basically our entire like moral outlook on the world is relativized into an abstract universal moral framework and has to be justified in those terms, where we can't just assert ourselves on the basis of ourselves, that we can't basically measure ourselves by the terms that we create. We can't create our own values. We can't assert ourselves as an individual people. Instead, everything has to be, what are the universal rules of humanity, and how can we devise them in such a way that they're fair and apply to everyone? Well, what that is ultimately is a rationalization of globalism, a rationalization of a humanitarianism that conquers European particularism and overcodes it with some project of global racial integration. I don't believe in that. I don't believe in kind of trying to compromise with that framework. I believe in repudiating that entire position on the metaphysical level with the metaphysical alternative, and trying to represent that in my politics. I think if you try and do that in a racist way, they're going to call you a Nazi, and they're going to be more or less correct. Like, you can have an argument against it, but you're basically doing more or less the same thing in the essence as what the Nazis were doing. So I think you just have to accept it.
So with this argument, I want to add something that people in the chat have been saying. I've been sort of watching what the chat's been saying. Now, I'll say this. I find it a little bit odd that all of a sudden there has been this sort of attack on people who discuss National Socialism, that call themselves National Socialists. I don't understand why that is all of a sudden. And the reason I don't understand this is because there seemed to be a period of time where National Socialism became less and less popular. But since 2016, more and more people have been talking about it. And there was an article in the news recently that AI translated Hitler speeches were going viral on TikTok, and they were being watched by millions and millions of people. You've even had a famous sort of UFC fighter come out recently and started talking about, you know, maybe Hitler wasn't that bad. You had, before the last election here in Britain, one of the Reform Party candidates came out and said, look, it would have been far better if Britain had allied with Hitler, if we'd never gone to war with Germany. That would have been the best option. And I see this coming more and more into the mainstream. And I find it odd that as this is becoming more mainstream, just as talking about sort of Zionist, Jewish, Israeli influence has become more and more mainstream, there does seem to be some people just out of nowhere saying, look, we need to drop this NS stuff. We need, you know, no one should be talking about that. No one should ever be bringing this up, least of all now. I do find that a bit strange, because one thing that I've always praised the left for is tactically, and not because I like any of their ideas, but the left coexist. So you will have the radical left who coexist with the center left, because the center left view the radical left as part of the tug of war, and they see them as the ones at the end of the rope pulling hardest to move the Overton window in the direction that they need it to go. Whereas on the quote-unquote right, you have the very opposite. You have the sort of the center right, you have more moderate sort of nationalists attacking those to the right of them and saying, look, you know, we need complete disassociation with these people. We need to rubbish their ideas. We need to bring them down. And this has gone on for years. But I just find it very strange at the moment that all this would blow up, just as many of the arguments that you make are going more mainstream, and people who are either in the mainstream or, you know, on mainstream social networks are being exposed to these arguments, and many more of them are sort of liking what they see. What do you think caused this sudden sort of, group condemnation of these arguments going mainstream from people who are really part of the radical right? You know, Keith isn't part of the mainstream right, and neither are many of the people who have criticized this. What do you think led to this criticism?
Well, obviously, like you said, the problem with conservatives is that they allow the left, their ostensible apparent enemies, to dictate their standards to them. On the left, that doesn't happen. Like Anthony Albanese, who's the Prime Minister of Australia, the head of the Labour Party right now, he's a card-carrying member of the Communist Party in the 1980s. He was Antifa, and like he was literally an Antifa, and he was a communist, openly so. Conservatives will call him a communist, or people on the right will call him a communist all the time. It doesn't matter, because no one on the left is canceling him. Like, oh, we can't let this ex-communist run our party. Can you imagine if it was the other way around and someone was like a national socialist in the 80s, and now they're trying to run the conservatives, some conservative party? They'd be like, oh, we can't allow that to happen because this would be really bad optics. Well, if everyone on the right just collectively shut the fuck up about it, it wouldn't be bad optics. In fact, you'd get away with it. The only reason you can't get away with it is because voices on supposedly outside of politics would criticize it, not what the left say. Because the left call everyone Nazis regardless. They call Peter Dutton a Nazi. They call Donald Trump a Nazi. They call everyone.
Can I just stop there? You just hit this most important point, right? You just hit the most important point that I didn't actually bring up. And I just want you to further this, because this seems to be another weird thing to attack sort of your ideology at this time, when the term Nazi has been more played out than it ever has. So, you know, right now, people are putting up posters all over London of Elon Musk dressed in SS uniform, flanked by Farage and Trump, saying, look, you know, Nazism is everyone's a Nazi to the left. I mean, in this country, the former sort of Indian conservative establishment of Preeti Patel, Suella Braverman and Rishi Sunak, they were called Nazis, you know. And I kind of felt that the term Nazi as an insult had lost a lot of its power, and that was strengthening the nationalist cause. So that's another weird reason why this just came out. Sorry, I butted in there, but you just...
No, but it's a good point, because people on the right, like, only care about what other people on the right are saying. They don't listen to left. They don't actually get, unless they're running the right, then all of a sudden they start caring about what left-wingers are saying. But the actual rank and file, the supporters, the right-wing base, does not give a shit about the standards of the left and does not determine its views on that basis. So if the right all got together and stopped punching right, they wouldn't turn around and go, oh, why are all these Nazis getting mainstreamed? They would just support them. So basically the gatekeeping function of the conservative establishment, it doesn't just exist on the basis of the fact that a lot of them are Jews and are obviously, you know, subversives, or a lot of them are ex-leftists, and or a lot of them are getting paid by big money donors that will stop paying them if they don't engage in this kind of behavior. That's part of it, obviously, a big part of it. But another part of it as well is careerism, is people who want to establish a career on the right, they need to signal that they're basically able to work with this establishment. So how can you signal that? Well, the best way to signal that is to be like, well, I'm not like them, and to basically just differentiate yourself, to pivot to the center from the radical fringe and differentiate yourself from them in some way, shape, or form. To be like, well, no, I'm not that radical, you know, like, you know, I'm not a white supremacist. I just believe in maintaining a white majority, or whatever the case may be. And you'll use all of these labels and so on to position yourself in a way that apparently make you more mainstream palpable. But for the average guy in the street, they actually don't give a shit about the distinction between these terms. These are terms that only matter to political nerds, that only matter to political people who work in politics. So I don't actually think they're that important in the grand scheme of things. What is important, however, is the way in which people denominate, I'm going to stay within this safe box. I'm not going to step outside of this safe box, so you can trust me. And that's all part of this deeper gatekeeping function of ideas that are capable of winning. I don't believe that we can negotiate the policies that we want underneath this moral structure, underneath this institutional structure. I'm a radical. I'm a revolutionary. I believe that the whole thing needs to be challenged. And a lot of people will say, yeah, I agree with you, Joel, but challenging the whole thing is going to be too difficult right now. So if we can kind of get within it, and we can do a little bit of work breaking down the legitimacy of that box, or shifting it gradually further and further to the right, then we'll move it into a position where it'll be easier to attack, where it'll be weaker, be more exposed to a radical revolutionary attack at some point. And I say, okay, fine, you go and do that project. But if you're going to go and do that project, step one is don't punch right then. Get in there and start punching left. Get in there and start beating up on the conservatives and calling them out for what they are, and refuse to acquiesce to the opposite direction. Refuse to acquiesce to the ideological leftism and so-called cancel culture and all of this kind of shit. Actually go in there and do your job. And there's people that are doing that. They do try and go into more mainstream discourse and function in that way. And I think most of the time, someone like Keith does try and do that. But there's a lot of people who, you know, they're ultimately putting what will ultimately advantage them. And they'll say, hey, look, I am not embracing all these radical and revolutionary ideas, so I can get platformed. I can build an audience. I'm not getting banned from all these social media companies, blah, 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 blah. That proves that this strategy is more effective because I'm not being attacked as much by the enemy. And it's like, if you're not being as attacked by the enemy, that means that you've compromised. Because it's kind of like a kind of a ridiculous logic. Like, the enemy has set the rules up of this game to prevent anything radical enough to actually challenge them from coming into existence. So if you're like, hey, look, if I just obey the rules of the game, the enemy doesn't attack me as hard. My political strategy makes more sense than yours. Well, that's basically like conservatism in a nutshell. Like, a lot of the time, it's just like rationalizing cowardice, rationalizing the path of least resistance, of gaining personal advantage at the expense of creating the actual fundamental conflict between our position and the enemy position, which is ultimately necessary. Like, this has to resolve into a radical polarization of society, where a massive portion of the white men and women of your country, where millions of them, are willing to support Nazis or something equivalent to that. How are we going to get there? And if we can't get there, I don't believe that we're ever going to be able to fundamentally have our values imposed upon the state in any meaningful sense.
So, I'll give you. I do you know what, Joel? I got to agree with you on this bit to a large degree, and I've said this to other people, and it's people have got to understand this. If you go out to the public and say, we want X, and then people vote for you or don't vote for you, okay, you know where you stand. Then if people do actually vote you in, you have a mandate to carry out whatever X was. However, if you go to the public and say, look, we're selling X, and people say, well, we don't want X, you're only going to get sort of 2.5%. And then you say to yourself, whew, well, that didn't work out well. Let's water this down. Let's water this down. And then over time, you start selling something that's very different, almost completely different to what you sold originally. If then when you do get to power or get a whiff of power, you try to do the old switcheroo and say, well, you voted for this, but we're going to give you that thing that you didn't vote for, what we started off with all the way back then when you rejected us because we were selling product X, but now we're selling, you know, a completely different thing to you at the ballot box. But we're now we're in, we're going to give you the hardcore stuff that you never voted for. That won't work. People would be absolutely outraged. And I think that's something that people don't understand. I think, you know, I think the issue that you have is that people that have gone down that softly, softly route would find it difficult to do the things that they initially set out to do before they went on the road of watering it down. And I'll give you a perfect example, Marine Le Pen's party in France. Well, Marine Le Pen's party in France have basically stated that if you are, if you've got a French passport and you love France and you salute the flag, you're French. Well, once you've said that, you're never going to bring about mass deportations or any form of remigration because it would be impossible to do. You can't then say to people, well, actually, the only people who are French are people who are ethnically French that we now define as white French people, because you've already given up that ground and people never voted for you for that. You know, people would think that was an awful thing to do. You know, probably a lot of your councillors, a lot of your elected officials would be like, what are you even doing? And I do think that if you have a radical program and you ever want to put that radical program forward and put it into action, you actually have to sell it as what it is. If you try to sell it as something different, even if you do manage to get somewhere, you will never be able to get back to where you were and institute that radical program. So in many ways, Joel, what I'm saying is that I do have a lot of respect for you and the fact that you do have a radical program, and you're not going to try to water that down because you understand that that wouldn't work either. And it's quite funny as well, because every party that I have seen water things down, they haven't necessarily achieved the success that they wanted to. So another great example of that is the British National Party. It achieved limited electoral success, very limited. Then eventually, when it wasn't electorally successful, it was destroyed. And really, was it worth selling out on everything it believed in to get there and end up with nothing anyway? So, you know, I do think there is a certain honour to standing on a patch of ground, claiming it as your own and being like, well, we'll stand here until the end. And if we win, we win. If we don't, we don't. But if we win, we're winning on our own merits.
And even for the people who want to water things down, my view is that if you want to, you need to maintain a kind of radical leadership. You need to have it at the very least within the right wing. You want the right wing base and people who are in right wing politics in every respect to have the maximum amount of rightward pressure, particularly obviously on the issues of race and related issues. So basically, you want to have a discussion that doesn't have rules that disclude the Nazis. Why do people oppose the Nazis? They don't oppose the Nazis, or they don't get freaked out by the Nazis because what is Keith writing about, like how they treated Slavic people or something. Maybe if you're in Poland, that's the case. But in the English speaking world, that isn't what's going on.
Do you know how the many, reason why? See, I don't follow Keith's argument there, because I've been involved in nationalism for a long time. And do you know how many Polish people I know that have attended events that could be, that could and would be described as national socialist events? I've never found that really. I think that's enough.
Yeah, but sure. I'm just saying that, you know, from the perspective of the English speaking world, that's not what the controversy is built in. The controversy fundamentally oscillates around the notion that the Nazis were the ultimate anti-Semitic racist political force. And the other stigma, I guess, is to do with the authoritarian style of governance, right? And that basically is where the stigma comes from. So do you want a right wing that is willing to basically seize state power and use it against their enemies in a way that goes beyond the limit set for it by liberalism? Do you want a right wing that is radically racist? Do you want a right wing that is radically anti-Semitic? Well, if you want these things, then you have to take the kind of moral training wheels off and allow us into the discourse and allow us to pressure the discourse in our direction. That's the only way this is going to work. You're not going to be able to cancel Nazis and also achieve those ends. Then you're undermining those efforts at the very least, because you're creating the opposite pressure system. But anyway, the other point that is often made around these subjects is that white people don't consider genocide to be moral, and they get freaked out by militarism. And so what was the term that Greg Johnson used after the stream into the night? It scares the hoes. Being a Nazi scares the hoes. And my response to that is obviously,
who are the hoes?
It's a phrase, like scaring the hoes. You never heard that before?
No, mate. We say it's like spooks the cattle or something like that. We're British here, mate. We don't use words like hoes.
Okay, well, it's a funny phrase.
A hoe is a gardening tool, my friend. We're not in the ghetto tonight.
But anyway,
I'm only joking with you, mate. I'm only joking.
Yeah, but my response to Greg was that, well, there's not going to be any non-hoe scaring solution to this. Like, we're talking about an existential battle for the survival of our race, taking on the entire political establishment, taking on the people who run the world and defeating them. It's going to require militancy. It's going to require aggression. And if you don't have that, you actually don't have a basis for people to actually believe in you, because you're not actually projecting a sense of power or authority or a fighting spirit. That's what's necessary. If all you are a bunch of nerds in suits with ideas and with arguments, well, that isn't actually the foundation of power. Like, you need to have good arguments. You need to be well presented. What you also need to have is a willingness to fight, a willingness to struggle, a willingness to suffer, a willingness to make sacrifices, and an aggression. And you need to have that needs to be rooted in what is fundamentally a confrontation with existential reality. The problem that white people face most fundamentally is not that they don't have the right ideas. It's that they're too cowardly to even come to the obvious conclusion, because the obvious conclusion has very scary ramifications. If you accept the fact that we are ruled by traitors and hostile alien elements that hate us and want us dead as a people, that are purposefully executing a plan to eradicate our race from existence, and that basically there's nobody in politics that really has our back, and that we have to build a grassroots movement from scratch under a hostile government to overthrow and resist it to the point that we can regain our existence. If you have to accept that reality, which is the reality, if you don't accept that's the reality, you're wrong. That's the reality. If you're going to accept that you live in that world, that's a scary world. That's a very scary world to live in. That's not something that makes you feel good right? And so it feels a lot better to believe that that isn't necessarily the case. That actually, oh, we just need to win the argument. Oh, we just need a better marketing strategy or whatever. Particularly if you're a weak cunt. Like if you're a low testosterone male, you are going to be less likely to be able to accept reality because you are biologically predisposed to being more of a herd animal. You're more afraid of standing against the collective. You're more afraid of conflict. You're more conflict avoidant. And so you're going to naturally psychologically bias towards a conflict avoidant strategy and that and a sense of reality where, oh, these people just aren't making the right arguments. If you just made the right arguments, if you just said the correct assembly of words like what I say, then the people that hate us would be defeated in the battleground of ideas, and we would win. No, no, no. The problem is that white people aren't fucking fighting back. The problem is that our race are a bunch of pussies. Fundamentally, that every single day, millions of white people around the world make the decision to turn the blind eye, to take the paycheck, to keep their head down, because they don't want to pay the costs of sticking their head up and resisting. That's why we're in this fucking position. So many of our ancestors took the Jew money, or they as I said, they basically let an insult on their honor occur and just let it happen. They didn't react. And a whole series of those decisions were made again and again and again and again till we get here. So that's why we're in the position that we're in. It's our own fucking fault. It's our own weakness, fundamentally. It's not because white people haven't been convinced that it's moral necessarily for them to continue existing. The reality is that most white people like existing and don't really like immigration and so on. It's that they're too scared to come to the conclusions that that implies, you know? So that's what we need. We need a movement that inspires people to have courage, inspires people to express honor, that galvanizes people and provides solidarity where maybe when you're the only guy that's kind of standing up, that's more scary. But if you're standing up and you're surrounded by brothers who are organized at scale, standing up beside you, you have a lot more confidence to stand up. So it's about how do we bring confidence back to the white man? How do we deal with this white demoralization? How do we deal with this white cowardice? To me, that's what the movement is fundamentally about in a kind of spiritual and cultural sense. It's not about how do we have the best argument why mass immigration sucks. We've already won all those fucking arguments. The majority of people are against mass immigration. Everyone can see the society is failing. The current system has never been this illegitimate. It's not a question of arguments anymore, in my view, or it never was. It's about creating a psychological and spiritual state to actually receive the worldview and act on the worldview. And I would finish with this as well. There are millions of Australians that have white nationalist or white nationalist adjacent views. How many of them do anything about it? That's the issue, is that they're not actually fucking doing anything. It doesn't matter that they've been convinced. If you convince someone the Jews are, you know, running the media and running the banks and that white race is being replaced, and they go, yeah, that makes sense, I can see that. And then they just go back to work the next day and then turn the football on and, you know, take the missus on a holiday and send their 2.3 kids to the local school, and they just continue on watching reality TV shows and shit. What does it matter what they think in their brain? It's not actually actualizing into a different way of life. It's not turning into political resistance. So everyone wants to convince these passive voters that maybe will vote for a nationalist party if it was marketed to them in the right way under certain conditions. I want to appeal to people who are like, hey, come and join me in the struggle for our existence. Devote your life to it. That's what I'm doing. That's what we actually need. I don't need fucking voters. I don't need opinions. I need fighters. We need fighters.
I mean, obviously by fighters, you mean political fighters, people who are going to do things lawfully.
And, yeah.
Anyway, look, let's do the Super Chats. If you haven't Super Chatted yet and you want to do the Super Chats, please do. You can donate via Odyssey or Entropy. We'll be reading all those out now. We've got about 35 minutes left. The first Super Chat is one that was sent to me by a guy called SR who gave $30. Thank you so much. And it's something I wanted to raise first and separately with you, Joel, because I do have one disagreement with you on this. You do talk about National Socialism a lot and about... your belief system, which I respect. But one thing you seem very down on is working with other ethnic groups who are also National Socialists. Now, I've always seen National Socialism as a movement.
You mean non-whites? That, obviously, I support working with other white ethnic groups, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. You don't support working with non-white or other ethnic groups that are National Socialists. Now, one thing, I've always found this a little bit strange, because people like Hitler, George Lincoln, Rockwell, they obviously did. And I firmly believe that we should work with other ethnic groups that want peaceful separation. And I also believe that if you look at National Socialism's fundamental strands that I opened the show discussing, where I said there's the national and there is the social, that does apply to everybody. So if you went to, say, a country in the Middle East, or, you know, a country in the Far East, and those people wanted a homogenous, closed-bordered society where their people worked hand in hand to do the best for them and obviously expressed their culture. You see, I think, you know, and I think people like sort of David Duke, Kevin MacDonald, many others would agree with me when I say this, you know, that really we do want a multicultural world, but we just want everyone in their own place, in their own homelands. And we want sort of a world of independent, proud people that celebrate their own cultures. But we just don't want all of that on our soil. Obviously, we do have a time limit tonight. I'm sure you and I could debate this all night long. But I do think it's kind of slightly antithetical to sort of National Socialism as an ideology to sort of oppose, you know, other ethnic groups that agree with that agree with the idea of peaceful separation and that everyone should have their own place in the world.
And my position has never been that we can't have good relations with non-white countries. Like, for example, Australia has a very strong military alliance with Japan. After the United States, they're probably our second most important military ally because of the fact that we share a region and various other reasons. And I wholeheartedly support that. And I actually respect Japanese culture as well in many respects. But even if I didn't, from a practical standpoint, that's what's in Australia's interests, is to have a strong alliance with Japan. We're obviously once great enemies. We fought World War II against each other, but now that's how I see it. So I'm not opposed to that on the basis of like some kind of trivial racism. But within Australian politics, or within the politics of any white country, what is fundamentally awry with whites is that whites can't figure out how to do anything themselves. Like just yesterday, I went to a Celtic festival. Right, it was celebrating Scottish and Irish culture. Obviously, the weekend after St. Patrick's Day, maybe that's why they organized it. It was more Scottish than Irish, this particular festival. And they were, you know, the kilts were on and bagpipes were going. They were doing Scottish strongman competitions and things like that. Anyway, I'm watching the bagpipes, and there's these dudes that are like, oh, I really value my Scottish ancestry, and I've got the whole regalia with the long socks, and I've learned how to play bagpipes, and I'm in this like bagpipe playing collective or whatever, and we're marching around in time playing bagpipes. And then he walks over to his Asian girlfriend or wife or something, and it's like, so that's how important your Scottish ancestry is to you, is it, mate? And then I see like a fucking Indian guy next to him with the bagpipe, looking like completely out of place next to all these like ginger dudes and stuff, and it's like, what the fuck are we doing here? Can we just have fucking bagpipes? No, we can't have fucking bagpipes. We've got to share the fucking bagpipes on the Celtic festival day with fucking Indians. Like, white people need to have our own shit. We need to have, in particular, our own political representation where it's just for us. We can't have a political party, or we can't have a political lobby group or some kind of political representation. If we can't even have that where it's just for us, how the fuck are we going to have a country just for us? Like, that's step one. We should be able to have an organization where only we can be a part, and everyone else, too fucking bad. You're not involved. This is for us. It's not for you. If we can't be exclusionary on some level, how are we going to build an exclusionary politics? It doesn't make any sense. Now, that doesn't mean that, as I said, non-white groups in other countries can't have a peaceful, amicable relationship. But if they're in another country, they can't really do that much to help us on a domestic level. They really can't. When we seize state power or something, then we can have an amicable relationship. But in the process of our domestic political scenario, it's really all that's relevant is, can we get white people organized at scale? That's all that's actually relevant. If we can, we can take the country back. If we can't, we can't take the country back. Everything else is a fucking distraction. If we can only organize like a tiny portion of whites, and we're going and wasting our time going and meeting with like some random group of Muslims and some random group of blacks and so on that are completely irrelevant to our struggle. It's like, what are we fucking doing here? We should be going out and meeting with whites. We should be going out and working and building up white communities, talking to whites, converting whites to our worldview, organizing whites into our organization. White power is the name of the fucking game. This is a movement for self-determination. That means it's a movement that where we are determining our own destiny. It has to come from our strength. And if white people are constantly looking to non-whites for help or for solutions and being inclusive towards them, it's just reproducing the same fundamental problem.
I think you're misrepresenting the argument. It's not about being inclusive. You're sort of getting very worked up about inclusivity and things like that. It's not about being inclusive. I'll tell you this now, Joel, and this is a fact, right?
Mm.
I could introduce you to 100 whites, okay, and say, and you could explain your belief of National Socialism, what you think it is, and try and sell it to them. And then I could sit you with 100, say, blacks or Asians, and you could explain the same. And I bet per capita you'd get more ethnic minorities saying that's a reasonable argument than you would whites. And I'll tell you this now, and this might be a hard pill to swallow, but I've gone and met black people who've invited me on their podcasts. I've discussed things with people from other groups and cultures. And when they talk to me, they never call me a Nazi or they never like have a go at me. When they inquire about our views, they are genuinely interested to hear what we say. And often the most pushback I get and the most screeching of the word Nazi is actually from brainwashed whites. And I'm not saying this because I want to get in this debate now. I mean, I'd love to do a debate with you on this at some time. It might be fun if people want that. But what I'm saying,
Mark, I've met heaps of non-whites that have been, there's still a lot of, I say this stuff and I've been pretty consistent about this. I literally go on my stream and say, if you're non-white, turn the stream off. I don't want you watching my streams. Get out of the live chat. They still do it. They still do it. Right? So it doesn't matter how racist I get. There's still a bunch of non-whites that are like, this white guy's cooking.
You see, Joe.
So what? What are they going to do to help?
You see, I think what you're saying here is also antithetical to your cause. And I'll tell you why. When I've seen the National Socialists, they were impeccably well-dressed, very well-spoken, very, very polite. And they wouldn't address people in that manner. And I think I think in selling what you're trying to sell, taking the kind of David Duke road is the better route. Now, I think if you look at David Duke, he's probably, well, he is the most famous and prominent post-war white nationalist, you know, post the man with the mustache. Duke is the big man. And I don't think anyone has been more popular amongst Arabs, amongst different white ethnic groups, and even amongst blacks than David Duke. David Duke is somebody who's respected by people of different racial groups all over the world for what he pushes. And I think that's more, you know, when I said when I first got involved with the BNP, you know, there was this heavy National Socialist undercurrent in the organization. But everybody there saw, they didn't see non-whites as just a simple sort of like enemy. And I think that's a counterproductive.
I'm not saying that they're all enemies. What I'm saying is that I want to have a space where white people organize our own politics amongst ourselves.
I'm not saying you shouldn't have that.
I'm trying to practice. I'm just trying to practice my ideas. I'm like, irrelevant what a black person thinks about it because they're not part of it.
The super chat was more about working with people, and when I see people like George Lincoln Rockwell, who worked with Nation of Islam and stuff, I've always seen National Socialism as a movement that will work with people from other ethnic groups as long as they are ideologically coherent. And I've seen
ones that live in our countries.
Well, the fact is, the way we are, the way it is now, is unfortunately there is a reality to this.
But you if know, they support us, if they support us, if they really support us, they wouldn't live in our countries. They just move home. It's not that fucking hard.
I don't think it's as simple as that. And I think one of the things that we would have to do moving forward, if we were to get to a position where we held real power and real sway amongst the whites in our nation, is you would need to sit down with people from other ethnic groups and plot a way to chart peaceful separation, because it ain't gonna be a matter.
Yeah. Okay. So when we've got a serious amount of whites organized and we have a serious political movement and we actually have strength and we actually can say we speak on behalf of whites because we've got enough support and we got a chance of taking political power, then we can sit down with these groups and try and work out how we can send them back in a way that's reasonable for everyone. But why are we doing it now? It's just a complete waste of time right now. We're not anywhere near that position where that becomes relevant. What we need to be focusing upon now is ourselves and getting ourselves organized and creating spaces where white people can talk about what's in white interests amongst ourselves, where everyone else is excluded. We'll let you know when we're ready to have a chat, is my view. Like,
it was interesting because before the Syrian government fell in Syria, I actually did a stream with one of the very influential men from the Syrian government, and he agreed overwhelmingly with the points that we were making and said, look, you know, you should be sending back all the Syrians that came to your country. You know, he said that. And I do think that politeness and a willingness to sort of work with other people who want peaceful separation is far more in line historically with what National Socialism.
I'm not saying we should be impolite. I don't think
otherwise you just become sort of this like pastiche of National Socialism, where you're walking down the street with your tattoos on your face and your bother boots on, and you're shouting at people, and it's basically all you expect at that point is Steven Spielberg to pop out from a lamppost and shout "Lights, camera, action!" And it goes on the TV, and it's kind of like negative reinforcement of what.
But it's not negative. My worldview is very simple. I believe white people collectively have the strength to control our own destinies. And all that is required is for us to have the self-consciousness and strength of will to do so. That's my message. We don't actually need any of these other groups' help. We actually don't need their help. That doesn't mean that I want to kill them all. We don't need their help. We need our own help. So when we start helping ourselves and we get strong, then from a position of strength, we can sit down at the table and try and work out and negotiate, you know, what's ours and what isn't ours with these other groups. But we're not in a position to sit down and have that negotiation yet. So it's an utterly pointless waste of time and a lot of energy. I've seen this from people like, I don't want to name names. I know that, for example, Lucas Gage is kind of, we had debates like this back in the day, and he's kind of recognized like a shift in strategy is needed to a large extent. But all of this energy went into trying to convince all these non-whites that Jews are the real enemy, not whites, and they should ally with us and so on. And it all amounts to nothing, because at the end of the day, they have their own people, they have their own perspective, they have their own concerns. And if they were more concerned about us than their own people, there'd have to be something wrong with them. So there's no point sitting down and negotiating with them from a position of empathize with us. Poor Whitey, that's fundamentally weak and it's ridiculous. We want to develop strength, and then we can sit down from a position of strength and say, these are our interests. Here's the benefits of cooperating with us and going along with us. And here's what happens if you don't cooperate with us. What would you like to do? And we can sit down as gentlemen and be very rational about it and very gentlemanly. And everyone can wear suits and shake hands, and no one's calling each other names. That's what I want to do. But I see so much time wasted in this movement from banging on about how we stand with the Palestinians and we stand with the Syrians. And obviously we oppose Israel. We don't want to support Israel and the parasite that is Israel and Zionism. But at the same time, it's kind of their problem at the end of the day. That's their side of the world. I care about my countries or our countries. I care about our people and securing our future. That's what I'm focused on. I'm not focused upon giving all of this moral and emotional energy to non-whites. That is really the problem with whites. We've given way too much moral and emotional energy to others and nowhere near enough to ourselves. I am the person that comes along and says, that's fundamentally wrong. I'm going to have a pure version of my worldview and express it to you because I fundamentally have confidence in our own race. I don't think we need anybody else. We don't need anybody else to achieve what is necessary. If we get whites organized in Australia at scale, we take Australia back. Same thing in Britain, well, look, same thing everywhere
I'll
else.
I'll say this, right? I respect your optimism, but this is where I fear that you're going wrong, in that you said something there about sort of who cares about the Israeli issue, who cares about this. I'll tell you this now. If you don't cut the strings on your puppet politicians that are all dancing to the Israeli tune, because that's who hold the strings, is Israel, then you're never, ever going to be free. And one of the reasons why I thought this was an interesting debate tonight is because the vast majority of people who are, I'm not saying all, but the vast majority of people who are antithetical to everything you're saying, who are opposed to everything that you are, Joel, are busy cucking on this issue whilst all sucking up to the Zionists. And do you know why I believe that you were kicked off Twitter, X? It wasn't because, you know, you're pro-white. It's because you're NS. And that's the step they don't want to allow. It's because you weren't one of the people saying, well, look, if we just get rid of the Muslims and treat them really badly and shout rude words at them, everything will be fixed. Hey, which is what the people on Twitter and X say in abundance. And I'm just saying, you know, I'm not saying that we need to be friends with everyone, you know, but the fact is, most,
you can sit down and have a chat. I've talked to non-whites before. I've had plenty of amicable chats with non-whites who are, you know, woke on the Jews or whatever. But what I'm saying is I don't think you can really build a politics out of these conversations. The politics that we can build is white people coming together for white interests. That's the politics I believe in. So that's the name of the game. And I think too much energy gets wasted if you deviate from that too far. That doesn't mean being rude to non-whites, particularly ones that are sympathetic. I've met sympathetic Asians, blacks, Arabs, whatever. And I don't call them slurs and like punch them in the face or something. You know, I'm a supreme gentleman, but they're not coming to the NSN rally. You know, they're not coming to the.
I'm not asking that, but the reason you're not on, if you look at the groups that have been banned off X, if you look at the individuals that have been banned off X, they're all people that went beyond what is the confirmed and allowed parameters. And the confirmed and allowed parameters on that godforsaken platform are that ultimately you can be pro your own country as long as you're pro your country being ruled by Zionists in Israel. And by taking the stance you took, you see, the problem with NS and what they fear about National Socialism is National Socialism, by its very definition, is anti being ruled by Israel. It's anti being ruled by anybody that is from another group. And the fact is, they don't mind on X now if you advocate for sort of, you know, a white America or a white Britain, as long as that white America or largely white Britain is still being ruled by a little fiefdom in the Middle East.
But they also don't mind if you advocate for Palestine like a leftist on the basis of the poor Palestinians and look at what's happening to them. The distinction between my view is that I oppose Israel and Zionism not on the basis of sympathy with Palestinians, but on the basis of asserting white interests. We gain absolutely nothing from Israel. We gain absolutely nothing from our support of Zionism. And our entire political system has been hijacked by it. How much blood and treasure have we expended in invading Iraq and all this other nonsense that has absolutely zero benefit to us? And Zionists control the media. Zionists control the political process, even in Australia. So I speak about it from the basis of Australian interests, white interests, not from the perspective of sympathy with Palestine or Syria. Because the thing is, number one, that's the fundamentally wrong orientation. We should be relativizing everything in politics towards what's good for us. That's nationalism. Number two, also, this idea that we should tack, there's another idea, which is that, well, yeah, we don't really care about Palestine or we don't really care about Syrians, but we should pretend to, because at the moment it's going to cause problems for Jews, right? So we should pretend to. And my response to that is, not only do I dislike playing games, like manipulative games, I believe in authenticity, but number two, the average patriotic white guy that I know doesn't give a shit about fucking Palestine or Syrians. They don't like Muslims in general. And so if I start positioning myself like a leftist, pretending that I care about these things, they're actually going to get turned off. And I'm actually pushing them into the arms of the Tommy Robinsons of the
world. Joe, right. You see, this is where, if you don't mind me saying it, your argument kind of falls to pieces. Because if you're saying you can't take a principled stand over Palestinian children being killed because it might turn off Grug nationalists, well, you know what also turns off Grug nationalists? Hitler and swastikas. So if now we're trying to appeal to the Grug nationalists with, well, let the Israelis bomb Palestinian schools, I'm not going to say anything about that. You might as well drop your Swazi and your NS stuff as well, because that also annoys Grug nationalists.
Well, not really. I'm not saying what I'm saying is that what the perspective that they haven't heard, what they've heard is fuck Muslims on one side, and then on the other side, like, it's a Jew-Muslim dispute, and it's, should we sympathize with the Jews or should we sympathize with the Muslims? I'm coming along with the third position of, let's sympathize with ourselves. We don't have to pick Jew or Muslim. We can pick us. And that is the correct position, right? Because fundamentally, it's a movement for us. We're not a Muslim movement. We're not a Jewish movement. We're a movement for white people. So I'm coming along with that position and saying, well, here's... Let's get outside of that false dichotomy. Let's take our own side here. That's actually a very compelling message that has a lot of appeal, I think, actually. And it's important to deal with the anti-Muslim, pro-Jewish element on the right, which we're directly competing with in particular. Thirdly, it's actually what I really believe. None of us are willing to go, maybe some people are idiotic enough to do this, I don't know. But pretty much none of us are willing to actually go and fight for any of these Muslim countries in their struggles of national independence, or contribute anything really of that much significance beyond firing off a few tweets of moral support. However, we're willing to fight and die for our countries. So let's just be honest here. Let's just be honest here and talk about it in terms of our interests and our nation. We don't need to go and adjudicate genocides on the other side of the planet. Everyone getting that passionate about the morality of the Rwandan genocide, or what the Azerbaijanis are doing to the Armenians, or what the Chinese are doing to the Uyghurs, or any... No one's getting that passionate about any of that. You're pretending to care about the Palestinians because you hate Jews, which is, I understand it. That's fine. That's great. But on a certain level. But on another level, it's like, let's be real here. We don't actually give a shit about Palestinians. We actually don't. We're just pretending to because we don't like Israel. So why don't we just talk about the real reasons why we don't like Israel, the pro-white reasons, and just cut the bullshit?
But I don't think it is bullshit. I think having a decent, rounded worldview is part of the National Socialist mindset. I think part of the National Socialist mindset historically was having a rounded worldview. And all I'm saying is that I don't want to see my people genocided. I don't want to see millions of people coming here from all over the world and wiping out indigenous Brits, but nor do I want to see Israeli jets wiping out Palestinians, and nor do I want to see Israel destabilizing the Middle East for the 20th time and millions more Muslims pouring out of the Middle East into countries like Britain, Germany, and France. And
but if it wasn't Israel doing it, you wouldn't care, Mark. Like, if it was Egypt doing it.
Well, of course I'd care. If it was anyone doing it, and it's creating an endless stream of people who are then funneled into Europe, I don't want it happening. I don't want, you see, I don't want Western countries selling weapons to Africa so that they destabilize their countries and then all the people coming flowing here. What you want is a world where there are defined borders, people have a place in the world, and you're constantly not kicking hornets' nests, because those hornets' nests, when they're kicked, you know, it's our kids that end up getting stung. And fundamentally, you know, I think that when I see what Jews do, and to say that I don't care who does it, it's completely wrong. You know, if you look at my history, my political history, I opposed the war in Iraq. I opposed the war in Afghanistan. I opposed American invasions of numerous countries. Why? Because I think all of this is part of sort of a wider sort of globalist, internationalist agenda, which isn't good for white people either. You know, ultimately, the most important thing is what is.
Yeah, it's not good for white people. That's why we should oppose it on the basis of bad for us. Those, rather than going on about.
But Israel's dominance in the Middle East is bad for white people.
Yeah, I agree. We're not disagreeing about opposing Israel, obviously. It's about what are the reasons, like, how are we framing it? You know, I just believe in framing things.
I just said it's bad for white people, because if you what was the first thing that Israel demanded when they wanted to empty the whole of Gaza? The first thing they did was meet people like Tony Blair and talk about sending 2 million Palestinians to Europe. It'd be disastrous. We're on the knife edge as it is. Why would you want any more of them here? You know, I oppose Israel's dominance in the Middle East. It's bad for white people. But I also don't like seeing pictures of Palestinian babies with their limbs blown off. As a father, that sickens me. And people who can do that are just demonic. You know, there is that aspect,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, okay, but like,
know, I'm a racial nationalist, but I don't want to go around seeing children blown to pieces by sort of demonic warmongering Zionists who think it's hilarious and then want to sell up the little bit of land that they used to have to build condos on so Trump and his stupid son-in-law can rub their greedy hands and make another real estate deal.
I mean, that's all fine and reasonable, but nevertheless, I think you can also see what I'm saying here, which is that I think we need to anchor our politics just fundamentally in ourselves and our own interests. And what are we actually concretely willing to fight for and not? Because there's been this attitude that's been too pervasive of like this kind of like world police attitude where we've got to morally dictate to all of these non-white countries what they're like, how their political systems need to be structured, which is a way to anchor us into these foreign conflicts and anchor us in. And I know you're opposing things. I know you're taking the opposite view to the Americans.
You are totally wrong in what you're saying. The whole world police mentality comes from Israel. The whole world police. We had two wars with Iraq, with the globalist American system run by Israel being the world police. I'm not saying we need to be the world police. I'm saying we need to morally oppose foreign invasion.
But the left-wing, right-wing distinction in the mainstream has been either you sympathize with this set of foreign victims or this set of foreign victims. Like, you know, we got to take its side in all of these foreign conflicts where there's one side that, you know, the leftists like, and one side that the Zionists like, and then it flips back and forth between who we're supporting. And it's like, you know what? Fuck all this bullshit. Australia first, America first, whatever, right? Like, let's just, our military and our money and our blood should be expended when we are attacked, when our people are attacked, to defend us and nothing else. That is
you just said screw the world police mentality. The world police mentality is the globalist Zionist mentality, where white soldiers are used to go to places like Iraq, where they either die, come back with some kind of PTSD, or their legs and arms missing,
I'm a communist foreign policy where we just have the foreign policy of the Soviet Union if it still existed or something, and we just whatever the brown people that the Zionist Americans support, we support the other group of brown people, and we play all these like team sports and waving all these weird foreign flags from countries you don't even understand the language of. It just becomes utterly contrived and alienating, and it's also disingenuous. We don't actually give a shit on a fundamental level. We're not willing to go and fight for it like we are for our own country. So why can't we just anchor it in nationalism and ourselves?
But what are you talking about?
Way better approach.
What I'm saying is nationalism is a non-aggression. We anchor what we're doing in what's best for us. What's best for us isn't going out and being the global police for the Zionist state of Israel.
Yeah, but it's also not it's also not investing all of your emotional energy in the plight of other foreign peoples that are the victims in these narratives either. We've got to invest our emotional energy and our advocacy in our own people. And that means, like, you only have a certain amount of care. You only have a certain amount of love you can feel as a human being. You have a finite amount of energy. I believe in investing 100% of that in ourselves.
What bit of not investing time and energy in ourselves is being supportive of these wars, opposing these foreign wars, is being supportive of white people because we are the ones who pay for them.
I'm saying I oppose the wars. I'm just saying we should oppose them. The reasons that we list, we should just list pro-white reasons. That's all I'm saying. We should oppose them from a pro-white perspective. That's all I'm saying.
So at no point in your world do you look at those Palestinian kids being blown to pieces and think, well, that's also another good reason to oppose it. You know, seeing babies have their limbs blown off, that's not a good reason as well. I mean, I've said, like, it's bad because we pay for it.
Yeah, but that's just kind of like an emotional thing. Like, I try to look at things in a very rational way. Like, at the end of the day, horrible things happen all over the world all the time. I can't care about all of them. I have to decide what I care about, what I don't care about, even though there's horrible things. It's like, wow, if that was me, that would be horrible. Like, you can empathize. But at the end of the day, I don't consider the plight of the Palestinian people to be my problem. I'm not Muslim. I'm not Palestinian. They're not my people. I care about my people. So I wouldn't be willing to go and do anything about it in a direct sense. I would be willing to do something about it in the sense of opposing Israel on the basis of liberating our people from the yoke of their occupational influence over our government institutions, and, you know, mobilizing our military. I obviously completely oppose supporting Israel in every possible conceivable direction. And actually, if we just cut Israel off from a pro-white perspective in our countries and let the Muslims have their way with them, I'd sit back with the popcorn and enjoy the destruction of Israel, obviously, right? Because that's what would happen. They only exist because of their parasitism upon us, because we defend them. If we remove our security guarantees and stop giving them money and weapons and sending our people to go and fight in wars for them, they're fucked. So that's a situation I'd be very happy with. And then if you see a bunch of Israeli children with their limbs blown off, are we going to be crying about that too? No. We're not going to be crying about it, because at the end of the day, they're not our fucking people. They made their bed. They lie in it. It's their problem, whether they're right or wrong. It's their fucking problem. So for me, I care about white children and a future for white children. And that's that. And you could say that's kind of harsh, but you have to draw the line somewhere in life. I can't care as much about, it's the same thing of, if I have children, I'm going to care a hell of a lot more about them. Like, if my kid breaks his arm, it's going to be the biggest deal in the world, and I've got to make sure he gets to the hospital and I take care of the kid and so on. If some random kid breaks their arm, I'll help him and do first aid and call the ambulance or whatever, maybe call the hospital and check on him. But I'm not going to, like, basically preside over his entire recovery process, because he's not my kid, right? So, like, there's scales of concern that you can have for others. And at a certain point, you reach the point where if a kid breaks his arm in Perth on the other side of the country, okay, well, some kid broke his arm in Perth. Like, I don't really give a fuck, right? It's nothing to do with me on a certain level. It's sad that kids break their arms sometimes, but you stop caring at a certain point. You know, your obligations end. Your responsibilities end as a human being at a certain point. And it's important that we reinforce that, because that's really fundamental to the nationalist worldview and what's being perverted in the minds of whites through the way the media portrays things and the way that a lot of these discussions are carried out, where they're carried out in these like universal humanitarian language all the time, as opposed to carrying them out in terms of what are our interests, what are our responsibilities, who are we ultimately defending, and what's beyond the scope of our responsibility. And that's all I'm advocating for.
Well, I can tell you this now. Every single nationalist movement in the world that was an ethno-nationalist movement at the time when there was the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, were completely opposed to those and were completely opposed to that Judeo-American globalism for a variety of different reasons. But if you're not, you're not, and that's it. So we'll move on to the next question. Thin Red Line gave $14 and said, great discussion, Joel. Have you asked Keith for a debate?
Yeah, a few people reached out, including Elijah Schaefer wanted to host the debate. You wanted to host the debate. And so I brought it up to him. And then he was like, well, you know, it could be good for exposure, but I don't know if I really want to be like, you know, positioning myself as attacking our own side or something, which I don't know how that really makes sense when, like, you started the debate. Like, why not finish it? Like, if we're gonna do these essays, and he put another essay out today, another essay on the same subject, which is good. I like doing the essay stuff, but it's like, surely let's actually hammer it out in a debate. Like, I think a lot of people would tune in for that. I think particularly because Keith and I are long-term associates, it'd be interesting.
The difference between a debate and writing an essay is a debate is a proper race where you're out in the fresh air and you're running against somebody who's running hard against you. Writing an article and sticking up online is just doing a time trial on an indoor track. You know, it's easy, it's safe, and you avoid sort of any conflict or embarrassment, and you minimize the number of variables that can go wrong. So ultimately, you don't end up falling flat on your face or being publicly humiliated by coming second, third, fourth, or being you know, everyone's saying, well, you didn't do so well, because all you do is keep doing your time trial until you get the result you think is good enough to post online. You do that, everyone claps, and it's very, you know, it's very controlled. I think a lot of people fear debate because debate isn't as controlled. Debate, you can throw some curveballs in there, and that can be embarrassing for people.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily embarrassing. Like, obviously, he feels his position is correct. So, and he feels he has the arguments. Obviously, I feel the same way. So, like, why not test it and, a gentlemanly debate, obviously.
That's what I'm saying. Huh? Test it. That's what I'm saying. It needs to be tested. Simply writing sort of like letters to each other online, I don't think is as instructive or as fun as a debate. And if Elijah Schaefer says he's going to do it, he's got a fantastic platform. You should do it on there. Simple.
Yeah.
Thin Red Line. Okay, we're going to have to get through these super chats because we're past the 2-hour mark now. Thin Red Line gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, we can't have ethno-nationalism without taking down the myths surrounding World War II, because every time you ask for closed borders or remigration, you'll always be met by this is NS and it will lead to the Holocaust. I agree with that. I've got to say this, and this is another reason why I find it so interesting that Keith came out with this now. I don't think in my lifetime there's ever been more sort of public condemnation of sort of the Holocaust narrative and public questioning of the Holocaust narrative as there is now. And I think the questioning of that, and I don't think anyone says like nothing happened whatsoever, but the questioning of the Holocaust industry, the questioning of the more salacious stories that surround the Holocaust, I think is something which, you know, does demystify this whole nationalism bad because it leads to this. And I, again, I find it interesting that at a time when this is happening, this is being said, what do you think about that, about the sort of demystifying of the Holocaust and the fact that is something that fundamentally has always held back post-war nationalism?
Well, absolutely. It's a key component. It's also obviously a reinforcement of specifically why you can't criticize Jewish power, that like if you criticize Jews, that is somehow the first domino in the second Holocaust or something. And so it creates this injunction that gives them all these special exemptions to get away with what they get away with without critique, or at least like public mainstream critique. And that obviously is, you know, really melting it down in a big way, because I think, you know, Jewish power is becoming so explicit now that there seems to be a lot of awakening to it. And a lot of people are starting to break ranks and start to talk about it in at least in a controlled sense. And so then obviously the Holocaust gets brought up, and therefore a lot more critical discussion around the Holocaust is taking place. And the Holocaust narrative obviously is very flimsy. And they haven't, it hasn't actually stood up to a open, fair, reasonable public scrutiny, because that hasn't been allowed to take place. In most countries in Europe, it's not even legal to question it. And in the places where it is legal, like here or in Britain or in America, you know, if you want to be a historian that works in university and in a university and gets your books published by a mainstream publisher or whatever, and have a successful career as a historian, if you touch Holocaust revisionism, you can forget about that, right? So even though you can technically still do it and you won't get thrown in prison, nevertheless, it's career suicide. And so there's a massive, you know, injunction. And also people then who do take a Holocaust revisionist narrative, no one's going to platform them to have debates against the regular historians, and the regular historians will gatekeep them out and won't debate them and so on. And so it's very difficult for there to have an open and frank public discourse. And as soon as anyone weighs into this subject, it's super controversial and doesn't take place. If you had a completely controversy-free, open, rational space where this could be debated, it would crumble, right? It would completely crumble. You know, chimneys that aren't connected, wooden doors. I mean, the list goes on. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, you know, it can't stand up to scrutiny. So even if when it gets a little bit of critical light shone on it, people do a few Google searches and think critically a little bit, and they say, wait a second, this is all bullshit. And particularly when you can see the political role that it's being leveraged for, like it's an idea that creates political power for a particular group. So you should always be skeptical of that. When an idea is being leveraged to generate a particular political outcome, well, then you can't just take it at face value, like which is quite obvious. And I think a lot of people can sense that. But I'm noticing a big shift where like older people as well, you know, older people in my life, in my friend's life, who, you know, were banging on about how the Holocaust was bullshit 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and they weren't having a bar of it. Now they're like, oh, you know, I saw this documentary and did you know this? And then now they're bringing up all these Holocaust revisionist facts and like weighing into the subject. It does seem to be a shift in the mood, which is obviously a very good thing. And at this point, you know, white identity politics is going mainstream in many respects, at least in a discursive sense. Critical discourse of Jewish power is going mainstream, at least in a discursive sense. The only thing really that's left is the rehabilitation of National Socialism itself being pushed into the mainstream. That's really like the last and most robust discursive gatekeeping that still exists. And so, insofar as people like us that are trying to like, you know, push that across the line, it's really about breaking that enemy control of the discourse. Even if you don't agree with National Socialism, if you're at least on our side, you should at least get out of the way and allow us to try and like push that through. Or actually, you should be helping, because open discussion space where we can at least consider National Socialism rationally and openly, even if you are critical of it, is still better for us than what currently exists.
Okay. We got another question from It Was Made Up, who gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, there's one thing missing from this conversation, and that's Keith. Do you think he'll do a stream with you about this? He seemed to indicate he wanted to put this to bed today with his Substack piece today, so maybe not. Well, we've already kind of answered that, but thank you for the super chat. Jagdeep Jaino gave $10. Thank you so much. Hey, Joel. Tom recently spoke on Keith Wood's cringeworthy and humiliating and cringeworthy DMs that were leaked by an adult worker he caught feelings for named Slater. She dated rappers and was disowned by her family. Why did Keith court her and fall in love with her? Could you psychoanalyze this?
This is nonsense. Next super chat.
What's nonsense? Having feelings for a girl like that or the super chat itself?
Oh, just talk. Yeah, just
joking, man. Do you know what, Joe? You're the hardest person to make laugh in the whole world. That was obviously meant to be sort of like a humorous super chat, and my response to it was humorous. It's like, obviously it was a joke. You can't psychoanalyze something like that. I believe Keith was just being polite to her, and she thought she'd got a big own by leaking her super chats. But the motto or the moral of said story is, if you have a complete skank like that, don't treat them with the respect they don't deserve. How's that for a hoe-owning comment, as you youngsters may say?
Yeah, true.
Arab Social Nationalist gave $1.88. Thank you so much. He said, perhaps what's happening here is that figures on the right are struggling with the terrible truth that is crystallizing in front of them. There is no parliamentary or democratic way out of the crisis of modernity. NS is necessary precisely because it is revolutionary.
Yep, that's one of my key points.
White Bracer gave $20. Thank you so much. And he said, hashtag Starfield team. And he qualified that by saying Australia is Starfield. Well, thank you very much. Dare Cheruska gave $10. Thank you so much. It's a great debate and powerful takes. I agree with Joel. The watered down version won't work. Thank you so much. Jagdeep Jenny gave another $5. Thank you so much. And said, people are open to Europa being fact checked, but Keith was saying bad faith stuff like Hitler was anti-Slavic and Jews don't have a monopoly on central banks or global finance. He was parroting Wikipedia. I suggest a two-on-two bare-knuckle boxing fight. Mark and Joel versus Keith and Alec Yerbury. Look, I've seen Joel in real life. The weird thing about Joel is some people look bigger on the stream and then they turn out to be small in real life. Like, people always say to me that I look a lot bigger on stream, but in real life, I'm a lot smaller. Joel's the other way around. Like, when you first meet him in real life, I sort of couldn't get over how sort of tall and well-built he is. I think if I was on, if me and Joel were double-teaming anyone in a sort of a bare-knuckle fight, I'd be very, very pleased that I was on Joel's side. He's a sizable guy, and he's got a good weight advantage. Arab Social Nationalist gave $1.88 again. Thank you so much. She said, if the answer to an existential crisis is not revolutionary, then it isn't the answer. You cannot accept that whites are on the brink of extinction at the same time insist that the response should be as polite and acceptable as possible. Makes no sense. Conservatism is poison. Well, thank you very much. Mitch gave $3. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, hi, great stream. Question to Joel. You said you went to India as a teenager. How come you went there?
Well, I was raised in as a Protestant Christian, and it was a kind of charity type arrangement that the church that I went to was involved with. So it was in under the auspices of basically helping out underprivileged children and so on. And I guess my parents encouraged me to go because they thought it would be an enriching experience or whatever. And it was an experience that only made me detest that group of people a lot more than maybe I otherwise would have. But although living in Australia, it's not like you need to go to India to know what Indians are like. But
liberal beanie wearing Australian buffoon. You make me sick. You say, I was merely sick. Do you know what? What I find even more sickening than seeing Palestinians having their arms and legs blown off is goofy white teenagers going to places like India to wipe their brows and assist them with medical aid, you liberal Aussie.
Well, actually, there's a statue of one of my ancestors in London in Trafalgar Square. And Charles Napier, and he actually he conquered Pakistan. He was the commander in chief of British forces in India. So I guess I was just heading back to old lands.
To assert your dominance.
Once ours. Yeah, they were once ours. And, you know, I don't want them to be ours again. You know, it obviously has kind of backfired, the whole conquering India thing. So
I can't believe this argument's gone full circle like this. God. I never thought you'd say something like that, Joel. You are the person. You're the person I could least imagine going anywhere in the world to administer any form of aid.
Well, it's pathological altruism. There you go. Like the white man.
That's what I mean. I just can't. After everything you said earlier, you say this now.
It's a foundation. But I think it adds authenticity to my story to start from a foundation like that and to have to develop as a man and attack your own foundation, criticize it, and develop a pure view over many, many years of arduous struggle, reading, trying out different ideas, and so on, to come ultimately to these conclusions as a fully mature, adult male now. So,
okay, well, thank you. Uncle A's Ice Cream Shop gave $5. Thank you so much, and said, "Hail Joel! Complete agreement with Joel. Generic nationalism will never work." You got a lot of fans in the chat tonight, and I've got to say it has been entertaining. We've had our own little debate of our own about the ability to work with other ethnic groups. But I've got to say, I found your passion and sincerity very important in this, and you know that certainly can't be questioned, and you seem to have impressed a lot of people with what you've said. Arab Social Nationalist give another 188, thank you so much, said the "I don't care about Palestine thing works fine if you're a Bolivian, but the fact is that the UK and the US are both parties to that conflict. If you can extricate white countries from the conflict, not caring about them is perfectly reasonable, but only then. Whites pay for it in blood and treasure."
Well, what I said is I don't support the state of Israel quite clearly, but you could see this Arab is obviously so emotionally invested in the plight of his own people that he can't even listen to the words that I said correctly. And he's, I don't love Palestinians enough for him. And this is exactly the problem with these fucking people. It's never good enough. I can say, I hate Israel. I want them completely cut off.
Be careful what you say now, Joel, because I don't want to get arrested.
Now he wants to fucking bitch about it, you know, like, seriously. You're getting the result that you want. Just be happy with that.
Okay. "Keep asking for the truth" gave $5. What? Somebody's just posted. Right. Okay, look. The Starfield stare. People meant that jokingly, so that's okay. I was going to say, I had to ban somebody in the chat earlier for saying something rude about me. But if anyone says anything rude about Joel, I will also ban them. I haven't banned anyone permanently, but I've given a time out to someone who said that if I spent as much time caring about white girls that were raped as I did about Palestinian children that were blown up, would have won by now. That person is a complete idiot, considering I faced 7 years in jail for speaking out against Muslim grooming gangs and were put on two of the longest and most expensive political trials in British history. So I spent a huge amount of time raising the issue of grooming gangs, and in fact myself and Nick Griffin were the first men in Britain to raise the issues of grooming gangs publicly and politically, and both of us were put on lengthy trials for that. I was actually charged with 8 counts of inciting racial hatred for talking about the issue of grooming. So anyone says I don't care about it is either historically illiterate or a fed. "I keep asking for truth" gave $5 and said, "Test it." Well, thank you. I'm not sure what I was in relation to. "And keep asking for truth" gave another $3. Thank you so much. He said, "Joel is too based for most to handle. Based AF, appreciated." He is very based. He's a good guy. And I'm pleased that he's fought the corner he has fought. Saturn 5 said, "Hi, chaps," and gave $3. Thank you very much. Space Can gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, "If we had 100 non-whites agree to National Socialism, 90 would still refuse to leave our countries. This is reflected from many hours of discussion on OME and chat apps." Well, thank you. I think that's Joel's point. And as
By the way, I see someone in the chat here trying to ask questions, but you got to send Mark a super chat. Like, we're not answering your question unless you pay up, bitch. You know what I mean? Like,
pay the money or shut the fuck up. To be fair, Joel, usually on a Sunday night, I do the questions for free because I'm captain. I am very charitable. Usually on the Sunday night and the Friday night streams, I do the questions for free. But we have written.
Well, I'm not doing any free questions. Pay the man. Pay the fucking man.
You see, there's a distinct disconnect between Joel and myself, and it might be an Aussie British thing. I'm very easygoing, humorous, and probably come across as sort of slightly nicer and less sweary. And Joel is sort of more hardcore, slightly more sweary, and harder to amuse. Why, but we have got a slight smirk.
Why is that an Australian thing? You're saying
I was kind of brought up believing that Australians were all kind of like Max Rokitansky and were just sort of like brooding hardcore people that lived in the wasteland struggling for that last drop of gasoline.
Well, that was one thing that I did feel when I love coming to Britain, and unless they don't let me in, I'll definitely be back. And I do feel very at home in Britain because it's my ancestral homeland. And I've always loved visiting and I've always felt very comfortable there from the very first moment I walked on the land and spoke to people, because I already have so many people in my life that are British, and obviously that's my ancestry, and Australia is fundamentally built by the British, so obviously that makes sense. But one thing that I did feel alienated by when I was in Britain was the fact that it did seem like people were a little bit more sensitive, like they were taking offense a little bit at things that I was saying. Australians, I guess we are a little bit more rough in a certain sense. When I got back home, I was like, okay, I can be myself. I don't have to like worry about coming across like I hate you or something. And people think that I'm like, oh, why would he say that to me? Is he angry? It's like, no, it's just how we talk, I guess. So.
Just for the record, and I'm going to embarrass Joel now, he's a lot more fun when he's off stream. When he's off stream, he's kind of like my naughty little brother. And I was driving around England with him, laughing and joking with him. And I've got to say, I thought I was the harshest when it came to roasting people and winding them up until I met Joel. And Joel is a master of roasting other people and winding them up. And I've got to say, he's endless entertainment. I wish I could draw this out of him on stream, because I did feel this immediate affinity to him when I met him. And I've got to say, I've met a few people over the years, sort of like Warren Baylog. It was fantastic meeting him, Blair. But meeting Joel was also one of the highlights. And, you know, I've got to say, like, one of the things that really disappointed me is that Joel couldn't come over for like Sunday dinner with the family and everything, because he is a really good guy. And I know we have the odd disagreement, but he is one of the people in this movement that I do respect the most. AWIVR gave $3. Thank you so much. He said, cheers, Mark and Joel. Son of Mars gave $5. Thank you so much. And he sent a little something that looks like a cheese with an Odyssey man on it. So thank you so much for that. Keep Asking for True sent $3. Thank you very much. He said, I don't ask. I just say increase the vril. Let's go. Keep on doing great work, Joel. Yes. Vril power. I know what that means. Sticks sent me here, gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, we don't need to be friends or receive empathy from Muslims, but if our greatest enemy is their greatest enemy, we could achieve our goal of conquest much faster, like the British and the Soviets in the 1940s. An interesting point. Somewhere between myself and Joel's position. And by the way, I'm not saying we should be best friends with anyone. I probably just have a bit too much empathy. But you can't hate me for that. Bluey Wap, well, maybe you can. I don't know, people hate me for a lot of reasons. Add that one to the growing pile. Bluey Waffen gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, we can be friendly or sympathetic to like-minded non-whites, but we must stick to our principles and not allow them into our groups, lest we risk turning an ethnic nationalist group into a Tommy Robinson-style civic nationalist group. You see, I just want to answer that one briefly, and I'll say this. When I see sort of like black people who want to remain black and want to separate themselves from us, I'm much more willing to go along with that. I don't want a Tommy Robinson style thing where Tommy wants a rainbow world, just minus Islam. He wants a rainbow world ruled over by sort of powerful Israeli elites, just without any Muslims there. And I do see, I don't know what Joel thinks about this, but I do see this kind of, how can I say this? So there's plenty of reasons to not want Muslims in the West, okay? And I don't want any Muslims in the West. I want to say, I want them, you know, Muslims shouldn't be here in places like Britain. I think, Joel, we totally agree on that, don't we? We don't want Muslims here in white countries.
Oh, no, bring as many Muslims in as you want. I love Muslims. What are you talking about?
Joel's finally gone crazy. No, so obviously we're united on the fact we don't want them here. But one thing that I think is kind of strange, and one thing about the Tommy Robinson thing that maybe Joel would like to comment on, is Tommy's got this weird thing where he doesn't want Muslims here, Muslim men, but he does want Muslim women coming here by the boatload. And I kind of find that the Tommy anti-Islam, so Tommy's reasons for being anti-Islam are in some ways different to ours, but his kind of view of anti-Islam tends to lead to this sort of desire for war. So it's like the Trump anti-Islam thing is like, look, we need to go to war with Iran, whereas I'm opposed to war with Iran and think as long as Iranians are in Iran, I'm happy for Iran to be the way it is. I don't know what your take is on that. And that's really what I was trying to say. Maybe I got confused earlier. Maybe I spoke over you. Some people in the chat said I didn't. If I did that, I didn't, certainly didn't mean to cause you any offense. What I'm trying to say is you have to be very careful about some of this anti-Muslim rhetoric, because it's anti-Muslim rhetoric which is designed to whip young white men into some frenzy where they're willing to sign up to go and fight in Iraq or Iran or somewhere like that at the behest of the Jews. Do you concede that at all? Do you think there's any merit to that argument?
Yeah, obviously. But the problem is when the criticism of Islam is built around Islam as an ideology or something, or as a worldview, as opposed to just recognizing it as a foreign alien element that doesn't belong in our societies, and that it represents like the kind of culture of a foreign race. That's the issue with it. And then secondarily as well, like, you know, Europe has been under siege by Islam in various respects for over 1,000 years. And like, so that history needs to be conscious and recognized. And so, yeah, like you can get this kind of Deus Vult, this framing of like Zionist foreign policy as if it's like a new crusade or something. And how based is that? But I mean, obviously that's retarded and disingenuous, and it's just ridiculous as well. Like, why are we going and fighting Muslims in foreign countries when they're in our own fucking country? Like, it doesn't even... So, like, we've got to protect Israel from Islam.
We can certainly agree on that. From Islam,
you know?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that point. I think we sort of come the full circle on this. I think it's been an interesting discussion. We've run to nearly 2.5 hours now. So I think it's about time we sort of shut this down. But do you know what, Joel? I've really, really enjoyed this tonight. I think you've made a very powerful case, both historically, ideologically, functionally, and well, in every way. And I've got to say, you are a true gentleman to come on and discuss these issues. I just want to say, if you've got a brief sort of 2 minutes, how you'd like to sum this up before we shut it down, that'd be appreciated.
Yeah, well, I mean, just to get back to the original subject, I think like the key point is this, which is that I don't think the thing holding back the white race is fundamentally the framing of arguments. I think the thing holding back the white race is cowardice. I think people have motivated reasoning. People want to reason their way into a worldview or into a set of beliefs that make them feel comfortable, that make them feel secure, that make them feel safe inside. And so the issue of cowardice and the issue of dishonor is more fundamental than whether this argument or that argument makes sense or not. I believe in the total rational coherence of my worldview, but at the same time, I recognize that it is a worldview that is prohibited fundamentally in the minds of many because of the fear of social ostracism or the fear of the ramifications and implications of the worldview, as opposed to the truth or falsity of the worldview just being rationally evaluated in and of itself. So that is also the framing of the National Socialist issue. Like, the debate is very seldom about the specific actual ideas of National Socialism, whether they are good or bad, or whether using those ideas in contemporary context would be good or bad. the debate is mostly about how people feel about the idea and how it freaks people out. And I think acquiescing to, well, this freaks people out, therefore we shouldn't consider it, it's just acquiescing to the same psychical structure that is basically putting us in this position in the first place. That whole psychical structure of cowardice, that whole psychical structure of dishonor needs to be challenged directly. And as I said before, I think World War II was a metaphysical war between the particular and the universal. And I think in order for white particularity to be defended, particularity metaphysically needs to be defended at the core of our worldview. And so that would be like how I would maybe summate, I think, the most important aspect of my position, and everything else kind of flows from there.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an entertaining stream. I think we've done a bit of everything, and we've given people half an hour extra than they expected. I'd like to thank Joel for being such a good sport and getting up early in the morning. I'd like to urge Keith, if he's watching, to please do a debate with Joel over on Elijah Schaefer's channel. Or if you need somewhere smaller and less famous, do it on mine, of course. That would be appreciated. I've had a great evening, and I'd like to thank everyone who's been in the chat. A few people made rude comments. Those people were temporarily timed out, but I don't give out permanent bans very often. So, but please do be respectful both to myself and Joel.
No, just come in the chat and call me Jewish and accuse me of being a communist and a Fed. It's funny. Like, just that's what we should just fill the whole chat with these accusations. Like, why even don't even like have the sound off. And just spam how we're fed communist Jews, and just maniacally just keep typing away and banging the enter key.
That's what the chat's called.
Why even do streams? We should just have a live chat where you can just accuse us of all these things constantly. That would be hilarious.
Jimbo's getting closer. A guy called Jimbo. There's a guy called Jimbo who absolutely loves one of your Telegram moderators. He's been talking about him all night. So apparently, before Joel kicks this particular hornet's nest so hard that we can't sleep for the next week because of the stings, we're going to call it a day. But it has been really good. Thanks for getting up so early, Joel. Thanks to everyone in the chat. I know it's been a heated debate, but from my point, I've got to say, Joel is a stand-up guy. I've really enjoyed it. Me and Joel agree on, 95% of things. We had a little bit of debate about something from a certain perspective. I do respect Joel's point of view, and I think everyone should support him as much as they can. I think he's a very, very brave guy, especially to take the point that he's taking at such a young age. You know, he's putting his whole future in this cause. And obviously, I wish him all the best, and I hope to continue working with him long into that future. So thank you so much, Joel. You're a stand-up character. Anyway, we're going to shut things down now. Thank you so much to everyone who's here. Thanks to Joel. Thank you much for everyone who donated so generously. I'll be back on Wednesday for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. But for now, thank you and good night, everyone. And have a lovely weekend, whatever's left of it. Good night.